The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
7:31, you're very welcome along this morning. For those of you who are joining us live on any of our social channels, you should really be listening on OTB Sports Radio. They've just done one of Richard's rugger things into the ad break, and it's very difficult now for us to actually present and live and actualise as a normal human being. It's difficult. It reaches a point where you're like, hang on, I'm going to sound a little bit too like the sketch here if I do this.
Watching Richard's rugger thing this week, he did a sketch that features neither of us. So it's almost like watching a horror movie and the jump scare doesn't happen. It's like, I can actually watch this thing and there's a sense of relief at the end of it. It was an amazing feeling.
It's too close to the bone.
Well, very close to the bone. He's exceptionally good. I've always said that. And he's very, very good at his job, even if it's an incredibly excruciating process, listening back to it and watching it. It actually gets shared in my family WhatsApp group. I get laughed at in my family WhatsApp group.
Okay, I'm reluctant now to say, but mine haven't done that.
Okay, so they've obviously looked at it and say, can't be sharing that with him. Whereas I'm still on the right side of it. It's okay to send it back to me.
But they don't know how you're weeping inside.
Oh, absolutely.
They're miles and miles away from you in Kerry. They don't see you crying into cornflakes every morning here.
They don't see me crying on the show here every morning, every time we play it into the show.
Yeah.
That's why I'm in tears, ladies and gentlemen, every morning here at 7:30.
Well, let's give him a bit more material and tell him about the time that you met Bono.
Oh, Bono's in the newspapers.
Yes.
Today.
I mean, everybody in Ireland has a meeting Bono story.
Oh, mine is exceptional. Mine is the best Bono story there is. Drinking in a cocktail club in Dublin one midweek night, and went into the bathroom and was at the urinal. Bono was
No. This is not what happened at all.
What do you mean?
We were all out.
There was about three of us, yeah?
Yeah. We were out. And I went, Bono's in the jacks. You're like, no way. No, he's not. You're fooling me because I'm like...
Now I recall that you had this sort of theory that I went in after him. I had to go to the jacks anyway.
No, this is not true. You were completely...
That's just
was
a very...
Was Tommy with us?
That's just... No, he wasn't.
Who was our witness?
Nathan. That's just a very strange...
Well, I wish Nathan... Look, Nathan is on holidays this week, but when he comes back, he can verify that exactly what happened was. I was like, oh, Bono's in the jacks.
And I still I had to go. We were... I absolutely
you said,
did.
You were like, no way. You were like as excited as I've ever seen you. It was like, imagine Arsenal winning the Premier League out of nowhere. Right?
That's absolutely, absolutely not.
100% correct. And you were like, no way. I was like, go and check. And you're like, yeah, okay. And you ran straight in and you came back out and you went, it is him. That's exactly
That's
what happened.
Absolutely
That's 100%.
Not.
And you know this is the truth. I am not in any way. And here's, normally I embellish these stories, but I don't even have to embellish this one.
Properly embellished
not even
that.
A single
you've,
bit.
You've properly embellished that. But anyway, let me tell you the truth of what happened.
Bono was in there with Googie having midweek cocktails. We were celebrating something. I can't even remember what. It was back in the old days before we had to get up in the mornings. And I think we did good Jane Lore figures. I think that was it. Was it a Jane Lore night? It was a road show. It was after a road show, was it?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. So you, me and Nathan are like... less sense than we needed to have midweek. It's all right. We didn't have to be in until 2 o'clock the next day. And you were as excited as...
Oh, don't get me wrong. I was excited.
Like All-Ireland final day. Kerry go 6 points up. This is the look on your face.
But I also didn't believe you. And I was like, I absolutely did not believe you.
And you went to check.
No, I didn't go to check.
Not because you went to needed to go to the loo.
No, I didn't. Because I honestly didn't believe you. I was like, well, that's obviously not true. By the way, I need to go to
the
bathroom.
But you were excited not believing. As in like... Yeah, maybe this is actually true. Maybe I'm going to go in and see Bono in the jacks. That was your face. Come on.
But no, I did go in and I'm at the urinal and I look to him and I was like, how's it going?
And he looked. Is he at the urinal?
Yeah.
Doing his business.
He looks at me, looks away, turns around, washes his hands and gets out of there extremely quickly. I'm like, what a great encounter.
Oh, creepy fanboy. It's your best look.
So I will accept that that was creepy in a sense, but I didn't follow him in there.
Yes, you did.
That's just it's a great way. I can accept how it could be viewed that way, but that's not the truth.
But somebody's making the point in the papers today. It might be Gavin Comiskey that or somebody else was making the point that Cian Healy. Oh, it was Brendan O'Brien. Sorry, Cian Healy was only born after the Joshua Tree came out, which is like their peak.
87.
One of their big peaks, anyway. And yet the ability of Bono to still connect with this group of people, I mean, he clearly, judging from the look on your face that night, could absolutely connect. You would have lapped up any pearls of wisdom, but he didn't even grunt at you.
Oh, no, I got plenty of pearls. Best moment of my life. plenty. No, I didn't really, to be honest. It is interesting that Bono is the celebrity of choice. I guess he does speak to a certain facet of the team that it's like, I think, is it CJ Standard talking about it? Or maybe it's Keane Healy himself talking about it in the papers this morning, saying, I'm interested in the band's longevity and how they've managed to do it for so long. It's like, is that a bit of a leap to connect those two things? Maybe not. Maybe he did have some nuggets to give, but he spoke to them for a long time. There's a photo on the YouTube Twitter page of him like pouring sauce over.
What was it? Was he? Explain that. What's he doing? Is it a pasta dish?
It looks like rice, doesn't it? And he's pouring some sauce over Johnny Sexton's rice.
Why, so he's serving them.
Yeah, at your service, Irish Rugby, I think is what he tweeted, or what you two tweeted. So that was kind of unusual. And then he does these very dad peace out poses where he just kind of like this sort of thing. With a signed jersey. Sexton delighted to have him there. And then there was like a big group photo as well. And there he is doing the peace sign, just leaning in a different direction. So how do you do, fellow kids? Certainly springs to mind. But I like, obviously, he's a big rugby fan. And I'm sure he was excited to be there as well and really enthused by the whole opportunity, as were, of course, I'd say most of the players. Maybe Jordan Larmour or someone had to do a quick Google, but I'm sure there was nothing that you couldn't possibly put his way and actually be kind of interested in what he has to say at the very least. Whether or not you take something from it is a different story.
Apparently he spent an hour and 40 minutes. The other news is that Paul O'Connell's been there all week and they've been kind of soaking up information. This is seems like a good move by Andy Farrell. It seems like a good move generally by Irish Rugby to have people like, so, you know, if he wants to get involved in rugby at a coaching level, he has some experience, he sees what the setup is like, maybe they could bring him in. Maybe, who knows? But like, we need to do more to help our best young coaches to get back into coaching.
It can do nobody any harm, I'd imagine, having Paul O'Connell around the camp this week. There's a picture of himself and James Ryan doing the rounds at the training ground yesterday, and you just think to yourself what you would have done to see those two in the second row playing together for Ireland at one stage, because probably the two best second rows we've had in the last 20 years.
Interesting to eavesdrop on that conversation, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And just to even see what sort of things James Ryan is asking at the moment, like what does he need to do to improve his game? What is he thinking inside of his head in terms of his own goals?
Yeah. All right, we've got to talk about Spurs very briefly. A very Spursy performance last night.
Well, it's hard to know like what to pay more attention to like the Jose Mourinho team kind of doing something that you would expect from a Jose Mourinho team, as in not bringing very much excitement at all, or to actually really give a lot of credit to RB Leipzig last night. It kind of felt like you've bought cheap flights on Ryanair. You've flown to a trendy continental city in Europe. And you get off the plane and you're like, God, they just do it so much better over here. The trains are on time, the public transport system is so good, everything is so well run as opposed to back home. That's what it felt like watching from a Spurs point of view last night up against RB Leipzig. Just an unbelievably well-oiled machine, far beyond the realms of anything that I think Jose Mourinho is capable of doing at the moment. Now, he's capable of doing things in a different manner, which is pragmatism, which is defensive football sometimes when required. But perhaps he's even lost his touch on that front. Like you look at someone like Julian Nagelsmann and you think to yourself, was he available? Could Daniel Levy's money have been funneled towards him instead of Jose Mourinho if he wanted to spark a bright new dawn? Like, obviously, this is all just because they were playing each other last night. I don't think he was properly linked with Tottenham. But like I was a big fan of the Jose appointment at the time. I thought that they might have some short-term success. That's my confidence in him is starting to be chipped away, although you do want him to have a full summer to actually put in place.
He's going to get the full summer, he's going to stay the full summer, he's there for the long haul, is he?
I'm sure he'll get to the end of the Champions League group stage next season if they're in the competition.
He's getting 17 million a year, so of course he's going to stay. It's like it's more money than he'd get from whoever is paying him to do whatever he would be doing in the off-season, so it makes sense for him to continue to be a football manager for as long as possible.
Well, from Jose's perspective, absolutely.
Yeah, all right. 7:40 this morning, Atalanta beat Valencia 4-1 last night. We've been talking about Spurs 0, RB Leipzig 1. Despite lacking a recognised striker, Spurs will need to find an away goal if they're going to earn a place in the Champions League quarterfinals. Beating 1-0 at home last night in the first leg of their last 16 tie at White Hart Lane, Timo Werner scored the game's only goal from the penalty spot. Atalanta have 1 foot in the quarterfinals. They beat Valencia 4-1. Man City have closed the gap on Premier League leaders Liverpool to 22 points, a more manageable figure of 22 points. De Bruyne has scored one and set Rodri up for another in a 2-0 win at home to West Ham. David Moyes' side are in the relegation zone and just a point from safety. Celtic are away at Copenhagen for the first leg of their last 32 tie in the Europa League knockout stage. Manchester United are in Belgium to face Bruges. Arsenal are away to Olympiacos. Rangers play host to Braga and Wolves face Espanyol. We'll keep you up to date on all of those games and Off the Ball on the radio this evening. In GAA, an injury time point for Barry Coleman earned Limerick a place in the semi-finals of the Airgrid Munster Under-20 Football Championship last night. So it finished 7-6 for Limerick against Tip. Limerick play Kerry next Wednesday. Is the Kerry Under-20 team good this year? Is it still the tail end of the minor winning?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there's minor All-Ireland winners there. So, what is it, three-year gap?
Two more years, is there?
Yeah, two more years of All-Ireland minor winners.
A conveyor belt. Clare and Waterford will play their rearranged quarterfinal tonight in Milltown Malbay, with Cork awaiting the winners in the semi. In golf, Rory McIlroy looks to get over his Genesis Open disappointment this week. The world number one plays alongside Tommy Fleetwood and Gary Woodland in today's opening round of the WGC Mexico Championship. Obviously no cut in this tournament, and barrels of cash for the winner. Open champion Shane Lowry and GMAC are also in the field. In rugby, obviously, preparations continue for Ireland-England at Twickenham on Sunday. And there's a seven-race card at Thurles this afternoon, with the first off at 5-2. Here's what's coming up on the show this morning for you. Going to talk Champions League with Graham Hunter in about 10 minutes' time. Top five stories that we're covering for you this morning. Brian O'Driscoll in studio from 8.15 for about 20 minutes. Going to preview Cheltenham with Tom Malone, who's been around the country at the biggest yards in Ireland, having a look at the fleet and force that we're going to be sending over to Cheltenham this year. Shane Byrne's going to join us in studio to help us preview the game as well. Virtual Insanity coming your way to try and make you some money from 9 o'clock with John's Tips, and the Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy live at 5 past 9 this morning, time of the papers. OTB AM. Starting with offtheball.com this morning, Niall Kennedy's piece from last night, a powerful piece where he spoke about his battle with bipolar disorder. This will save lives. Boxer Niall Kennedy on Mental Health Resource. He's a really interesting character. He's our best heavyweight at the moment, and certainly is in that tier of fighters who, you know, with a couple of wins, could certainly end up with a European title shot at some point or other. Andy Farrell talking about Bono's visit to the Irish camp, and Mark Lawrenson talking about Atletico Madrid, which we'll get into a little bit while later. Roy Keane sets about cannibalising his own unshakable legacy. This is a brilliant piece from Arthur O'D on the website at the moment, where he just points out, Keane said he was like a an average player himself, which would mean that he'd be getting the lash of his own tongue at the moment, and everybody respects him, or he's got the punditry game gig because he was such a good player, because everybody said he's a good player, but he's like, nah, I wasn't a good player at all. Then
people start believing him.
Well, I mean, you know, like, exactly, he's Dial that bit back. Start taking the credit that's yours as a good player, and it's going to help your punditry. Anyway, Arthur also compares him to Walt Whitman, so I'm all about that. Anytime you get the opportunity to, go for it. What have you got?
Start with the Irish Times this morning. I will go to Farrell ticking all the right boxes. It's Jerry Thornley's piece here, and Gavin Comiskey writing about Bono. His stirring words leave Ireland prepared for battle. A couple of interesting lines in that, which we'll come back to in just a moment.
Front page of the Examiner for you this morning is a picture from Close Sutton yesterday. Picture perfect, Mullen's eyes, another golden moment with album photo. And they also have Bono and Paul O'Connell together at last on the front page of the Examiner. Bono and O'Connell inspire Ireland ahead of Twickenham task.
The Irish Independent this morning says, Farrell says Furlong won't be fazed by strange Welsh scrum criticism. Croker League finals double bill is on the cards for the second year running. We could have the football and hurling finals on the same day in Croke Park. And I'm out. Tours boost as McIlroy rejects breakaway plan. He doesn't like being told what to do, Rory McIlroy. And for that reason, he is out of the Premier League golf idea.
Yeah, because it was intriguing a couple of a while back. It seemed like the players were going to have an ownership and there would be a stake, and so they'd have teams. A bit like David Beckham joining the MLS. They're like, you can have a share of a franchise, which will make you money into the, well, it'll make your grandkids money if you do it properly. So that now seems like it's not going to be the case. The Times, Guardiola, no way I'm leaving now. I hope that's right. I hope Pep Guardiola does stick around for the next few years and embeds himself at Manchester City and takes them through whatever difficulties they're going to have, because there's a possibility they might get points deduction as well. And Dele Alli just about to unleash hell on that bottle of water as he was subbed off in the 1-0 defeat last night. Bono's lesson in Irish pride made the back page of the Times. So they're interested in Euro's doubt for Rashford. Playing a player with a broken back, not a good idea. Who knew? Not a good idea, it turns out, for Man United.
Not Solskjaer's fault, according to Solskjaer. Back page of the Mirror is, bottled it. Frustrated Ali throws a strop on a night of misery for Tottenham. Pep says, I'm still leader of the band. That rash facing Euro agony, and it didn't go far. Jones's job, not for me, says Andy. So he insists he flat-out rejected Eddie Jones's overtures for him to ditch Ireland and return to the England setup. The offer was made after Paul Gustard's departure in 2018, and Farrell said that he asked the question and said no.
What? So go say again. Who asked the question?
England.
England asked him if he wanted to come back and replace Paul Gustard.
Yeah.
Right.
This is
while he was with Ireland.
So just to go into the full quote, he said he asked the question. I had a good job anyway, so that was that. It was no more than that. No. So he'd obviously left them after 2015, and said the decision. Jones had worked twice with Farrell at Saracens, and Jones has said that the decision not to keep Farrell was the toughest he's had to make. Now, it's nice for him to say that, but my honest opinion on it is that I don't think it was my job anyway, stated Farrell after naming an unchanged side yesterday. He's a very wise coach, he said. He's been through a hell of a lot. I've always enjoyed going for a coffee with Eddie and talking through those experiences. So clearly he likes what he's got going on, or liked what he had going on with Ireland at the time, and it seems he's paid off from right now anyway.
This is 2018, right?
2018. So
Gustard left in May. It says, Paul Gustard's departure leaves England... Leaves Eddie Jones facing a blah, blah, blah for the tour of South Africa. And Andy Farrell was named Ireland coach in waiting in November. So maybe there was a bit of a... Just saying, the lads want me over there. You know, if you're, what are your plans for me? Mm. It's a totally legitimate thing to do, right? The Guardian, the back page, is the celebrations from RB Leipzig and pep talks. Guardiola says players 100% behind fight against UEFA ban.
Daily Telegraph is, De Bruyne lifts City blues. Belgium's brilliant show takes champions' minds off two-year European ban.
The English Mirror had Rattle and Scrum as the headline over the Bono pictures. Here it's Sweetest Thing for Farrell. The U2 puns are out. You've got to pick one for Tab of the Morning. City are united. Business as usual. This is the second City are united headline this week that we had. They're all essentially the same stories. Rashford a doubt for Euros. He's not really a doubt for the Euros so much as... Solskjaer saying he's probably going to play a game or two at the end of the season, but you know, there's no way I would risk him in the Euros. If I was England, I wouldn't be picking him, because like
he wants him to reach the Europa League final so that he can play that game, so he could make the end of the club season. Back page of the Irish Daily Mail is, Standing Tall, Ireland ready to front up in Twickenham, and Ali bottles at a Spurs face exit. But interestingly, after the game, Spurs legend Chris Waddle called for Troy Parrott to be given his chance in light of the absence of Kane and Son. They have Troy Parrott. You have to play him. He's not even on the bench tonight. You know, you can say he is not ready, but how do you know? If you have a centre forward, you play him. So it's not just Irish pundits joining the clamour to get Troy Parrott game time. Chris Waddle also lending his voice to that take.
Mark Hurst, Ole, injury worse than we thought. Striker diagnosis was rash. Markers.
At least they've got Rattle and Scrum to back up that.
You are. Sub Delhi Stropspur. There's obviously the same person writing all these headlines, and he's like, oh, look, I'm phoning it in tonight. Eddie Mad, City chief and fan, slam UEFA, and Rattle and Scrum. It's like, I mean, maybe this is an all-time great back page. I don't know. I can't decide. Sub Delhi Stropspur.
The Herald leads with, rash blow for United. Striker ruled out for another few months, according to Solskjaer. Farrell is puzzled at furlong criticism, and Dubs rose from hell of 2011 clash with Donegal.
I don't get the Sub Delhi a Stropspur.
Sub is a sandwich.
Hotspur.
Delhi.
Because
they misspelled his first name, didn't they? It's D-E-L-I rather than D-E-L-E.
Yeah, okay, so...
What's to do with... I don't know.
Is there a Subway know. Stropspur, Hotspur?
Probably is.
I don't get...
Keep fresh.
It's like, it's too complicated. I mean, these are supposed to be like rudimentary English so that like... The general populace can get them. It's way over my head.
Over mine as well. Racing Post, it's boom time for Mullins. Last year's Gold Cup hero album photo spearheads formidable festival challenge. And then back of the Racing Post, it's hungry like the wolves. Wanderers in Roma smell blood in Europa League hunt.
Now, Virgin Media have over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. All of those games are available to all Virgin Media TV customers, who can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream the action whenever and wherever they like. Here's Brian Kerr talking about Troy Parrott last night. Have a look.
Well, if you look at the list of subs tonight, it's actually, it's almost extraordinary. It's a home match in the Champions League, and they've only got one fella that can possibly play in the forward line on the bench out of all the subs. It's Lamela. Yeah. There's loads of defenders. I mean, Endombele, Skip is there, midfield player, Tantanga, a defender, Vertonghen, a defender. It's Ndoyer, another defender. Yeah. It's really strange. I wonder how something happened to him.
Yeah, nothing's happened to him in training. As far as we know, he seems to be fit, and Chris Waddle was calling for his inclusion. Let's go and talk to Graham Hunter. Plenty for us to get our teeth stuck into. But first, I just want to ask you briefly about Jose Mourinho and the job that he's doing at the moment at Spurs. Leipzig obviously in a lot of good form, and we had Uli Hess on the show yesterday. He was kind of predicting that Leipzig's form was so good they were going to roll over Spurs anyway. But what do you make of the job Jose Mourinho's done so far, Graham?
Well, it's a big question, Ger. First of all, I suppose the brand of football isn't as good as we were getting used to over the seasons that Maurizio was in charge. Poch was a coach who believed in a different brand of football than Mourinho, as organised, as defensively sound. Do I put a whole lot of weight in what Mourinho says about the injuries? I thought he overplays his hand a little bit about, I've got nothing, the players are all dead on their feet. I don't enjoy hearing that, because from my career I've learned that footballers will, broadly, not Spurs, will seize on opportunities to say, well, it's because of that. And it troubles me that Mourinho domestically has clearly added the points that Daniel Levy desires, that they become competitive for the top four. It isn't going to happen, I don't think. But they're more competitive. And I think if you were to sit Daniel Levy here instead of me, and he was to be completely honest with you, then the removal of Poch and the appointment of Mourinho would be about two things: trying to, you know, initially trying to win the FA Cup and trying to get the top four. I'll bet you that Daniel Levy temporarily won't be caring too much about the style, which I know diehard Spurs fans are already beginning to moan about. So it's unusual. I don't want to sit in the fence, and it's unusual not for me to have a pungent point of view about Mourinho. But I think that a proper appraisal will only come at the end of the season, when he's got them either through this tie or into the European spots, kept them in some sort of European position. And I don't like the excuses. I don't like the way that he's already going, it isn't me, it's nothing to do with me, that the injuries are too much, or the players are dead on their feet. I'm not a great fan of that.
Reading Miguel Delaney's piece after the game last night, and he had some quotes from Ralf Rangnick, who's obviously the director of football at Leipzig, and he says, one, add maximum possibility to the team and act, don't react. So you need to dictate the game with and without the ball, not through individuals. And he's making the point that basically Spurs are totally reliant on individuals, and that is why it is very noticeable the absence of Harry Kane and Heung-Min Son, whereas a team like Leipzig would perhaps be able to get through their certain injuries. Like, they had absences at the back, let us not forget, last night, playing a few fullbacks in central positions last night, but they managed to get by because of the system that they have.
Yeah, they went back to a system that they haven't been using since the centre-backs have been injured. They've been playing a 4-4-2 domestically. They went back to the wing-backs yesterday. I think if we're making a direct comparison, then one of the things that Mourinho has stood unable to cope with since his absolute peak, which is at Inter, maybe the best year at Real Madrid. People keep talking about whether he's in the past. Time has passed him by. One of the things that Mourinho stands for is that when his sides were at their best, they were brilliantly organised. Each player was messianically devoted to their leader, and they played with what was then considered to be a massive intensity. You look at what you're talking about Rangnick is saying, and the way that Nagelsmann believes his teams must always play. There are sides now in Europe, Atalanta being one, clearly Liverpool being another, and I thought Leipzig were evidently one, that play a brand of football which is really clear cut, it's really systematic, but they play at massive speed. And Nagelsmann's theory is that you have the ball as quickly as possible, you win the ball as quickly as possible, which we've all heard under, say, Bielsa or Pep Guardiola. But then, instead of like the Guardiola idea, which is you pull teams apart, you go at teams. Now, Spurs, without me casting mud at Mourinho, and in the city where I live, Barcelona are other victims, Spurs were second everywhere last night, not because of a lack of quality, but because there are teams now that are playing at an intensity, at a speed, that even though Premier League football has helped to be very end-to-end and open and, inverted commas, attractive. It's not my favourite brand of football across the Premier League. I think that we're looking at a real split in elite European football. How do you want your team to play? And can you have a team that, with all the demands on it, because the demands placed on Nagelsmann's Leipzig players throughout a season, two seasons, three seasons, the same goes for Atalanta. Are they burned out because they're consistently at the top tier of every competition they're in internationally? Are the coaches getting back players who are pretty burned out at the end of every summer? And there's a disparity between which clubs can opt to play that way and which clubs have to be a little bit cannier, a little bit shrewder about the, not just the intensity of their play, but the speed of their play. And I thought that as good as some of Leipzig's individual footballers are, Timo Werner is a perfect example. He plays at massive speed. I don't think he's the most sophisticated forward we've seen recently. And his finishing is not elite yet, which he himself admits. Yet Liverpool are patently thinking about buying him because he represents that new brand of football. And I thought Leipzig won all over the pitch last night and should have won more clearly than they did had it not been, for example, for Lloris and some slightly sloppy finishing. And I don't blame Mourinho for that, but what you talked about, Leipzig's system, but also the core belief, is where right now the most punishing teams in Europe are at.
It's interesting that you mentioned the split in ideology almost in European football at the moment. And I was about to make the point that clearly one side of the split is winning if you look at the evidence of the Tottenham Hotspur game last night. But then I have short-term memory loss because 24 hours previously, the other side of the argument perhaps is winning with Liverpool getting beaten in Madrid. Is it fair to say that it's as binary as that, that perhaps Atletico represents the Spursy side of things?
I don't buy that at all because, in my humble opinion, I was worried about as what would you call it, as pallid as Atleti have been this season, and they have been, and as anodyne as many of their performances have been, they still bear the embers of that red-hot Cholo Simeone fire, particularly on big nights. And Liverpool, I feared going into it, given that I tipped them to go to the final again this season. When they play, and they are the polemic leaders of the, in my opinion, the Leipzig Atlanta brand of football that we're seeing being dominant. Given that Liverpool have reached two Champions League finals in a row, and you can't be at ramming speed as they have been for so long. Take a break and then come back at ramming speed. I didn't automatically think Liverpool would lose in Madrid. But I did think we'd see a Liverpool, which was more, I mean, in the Premier League, Liverpool recently, when they have found sides that sit deep and break are hard to play against, it's been about, again, individual things that rather than systematically that Liverpool have kept this pressure going at the top of the Premier League. And I think that very few teams now want to play Liverpool toe-to-toe or allow them to there to be an ebb and flow in the game. And Liverpool and Madrid, in my opinion, succumbed to one of Atleti's better performances of the season. But it was largely about the winter break. They came with cobwebs, and physically you can't go as a bunch. You can't stay at about 80 miles an hour if your top speed is 100, about 80, 85 miles an hour for two and a half years. Take a break and then go from 0 to 80 in a couple of days. And that was the principal reason that Atleti won the other night. And if there were a four-week gap between ties, I'd say to you right now, Liverpool will go through and handsomely. They've got 3 weeks to find that Leipzig, Atlanta, Liverpool pace, power, intensity, where teams can't breathe. If they find it, they'll go through. But I think 3 weeks is a short gap to get rid of the cobwebs that these players, their deserved holidays, their midwinter break that they had, has cost the club, cost the team. And it's natural.
I actually thought that was quite predictable. If you think back to last year's Champions League final, and I made this point on the show before the game, that that game was a terrible game of football because both teams were completely out of shape and out of form and hadn't played any football. And Liverpool find themselves, for the first time in their club's history, having to deal with a winter break, where Atleti are kind of like used to what the rhythms are going to be. And it was all set up for what we saw, and it really set up for a brilliant second leg in the next game.
Totally.
The shithousery is the word that's being used generally about Atleti was the other thing that I just wanted to ask about. Surely Liverpool know this is coming. They understand that this is how, when you play Diego Simeone's team, there is going to be a small level, and it wasn't even that off the charts the other night. It was kind of normal level.
Second, for whatever you heard from Klopp and Andy Robertson and Van Dijk afterwards, you're not telling me that you heard surprise in their voices.
Well,
of course
what
they were saying was, gosh, this was exactly the experience that we expected to have. And I think the way in which generally, you may oppose me because you're part of the British and Irish media, but I thought the way in which the reaction to Liverpool after defeat has been played up as a little bit of sour grapes, and they protested too much about Atleti. I don't think that they encounter Atleti-style teams in the Premier League week in, week out, or even once every 2 months. Atleti are different. Spanish football is very streetwise. You called it shousery. I'm not so sure about that. I think that Liverpool have gone unaccustomed to the taste of defeat. And if they're spiky and a little bit punchy afterwards in the mix zone or in the flash interviews, I'm not in the least surprised. You're right. Was it Atleti at their most dark alley down a Friday night dark alley where you know, the streetwise guy gets the first rabbit punch in? No, they weren't. I've seen them far more canny, if I'm allowed that euphemism. But all I saw was Liverpool going a little bit, right, okay, we'll store this up. I heard fuel for 3 weeks' time is what I heard. And they'll have loved the president of Atleti saying, yeah, Anfield, it's very atmospheric, but it's old and it wouldn't pass a UEFA inspection. You're like, Cholo Simeone must have been, what, president, what are you doing? What are you doing? Liverpool are already storing up the bad blood and that we'll get you back. And that's a tool when you lack a little bit of edge, when you want to get back up to ramming speed. I thought that everything I heard, in my opinion, Jerry, you asked me, everything I heard from Liverpool post-match was, right, we'll see you in 3 weeks' time. And that plays into your narrative about a brilliant second leg is awaiting us. I like to hear it, to be honest.
Very quickly, Graham, just as a final point, Pep Guardiola in all the newspapers this morning, speaking after the game last night, saying he's going nowhere, going to stay with Manchester City. Do you buy that, especially if the two-year ban is upheld?
Last time you asked me, and I said, when he's been saying these last few months, I'll be here. When he says these things, it's not a camouflage. Mm. The things he says about serious positions, he means. Does that guarantee against all odds that he's definitely staying? Okay, no, he's a human being. Things change. One, when I said that to you last time, I believed what I said, that he meant he was staying at least for the length of his contract. Two, will he be scared out because of the potential ban, which is a ban at the moment, and potentially losing players or not being able to sign? No, he'll dig in. So at the moment, I feel at least as strong as I did last time you asked me my opinion about his position, which is that he stays. Football's weird, and Pep Guardiola is an idiosyncratic man. But as of today, when he says he's staying, I thoroughly believe he means it on.
Graham, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Graham Hunt giving us his thoughts on what's going to happen. I think that Atleti are going to bring all their shithousery tricks and tactics. That was the warm-up. The second leg is going to be them at their absolute peak. 4 minutes past eight this morning. Brilliant show still to come here on OTBAM. We've got Brian O'Driscoll and Shane Byrne both in studio, as well as much more this hour straight after these. OTBAM. Top five stories making the sports news this morning. Bono in all the papers because he met with the Irish rugby team. Marcus Rashford now a doubt for the Euros, according to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who did, of course, you know, pick him that time that he was injured. Pep Guardiola insists he's going nowhere. We just heard from Graham Hunter about that. Spurs, a bit of a Spursy performance last night as they were beaten at home by RB Leipzig, and Rory and Reed. There's golf news coming your way. We'll talk with John Duggan a little bit later on about that. Some massive accusations being made about Patrick Reed and his penchant for improving his lie and the difference that it might have made in some tournaments coming out of America in the last 24 hours or so. There is a pile-on underway, and Patrick Reed is at the bottom of it, so we'll see what happens with that. But we're going back to Bono, your friend.
Like, there's a bit more to this than just the Bono showing up, and there's kind of a novelty value to it. Like, I know the players get asked about this in the immediate aftermath, and they had to give some sort of answer to Bono, but like, some of the angles on it are actually quite interesting. One of the things I didn't actually expect to come up when Bono was there is this identity, this idea of Irishness and your identity.
Well, I think that's why Andy Farrell brought him in, right? It was specifically on that topic, wasn't it? That seems to be the...
Clearly, but I didn't actually think of it as that. I actually did think of it as like, well, it's interesting to kind of look at successful people in different fields of life, and that's why he's been brought in. It's handy, of course, that he's an Irishman and that he supports the Irish rugby team. And Jacob Stockdale, speaking about this, he says Faz wants to give us a sense of our identity. He's doing that through our training, but also through things like speaking to Bono. And last night he talked about Irishness, what it means to be Irish and what's special about it. That's definitely something that Faz is bringing in and something we as a team are really buying into. It is quite exciting. And then you've got CJ Stander coming in on this as well. We'd always be interested in on this subject. He says, we asked him this and he gave a great answer. Irishness is not something you can put into words or something you can define. It is not something you tap into. It is something that is in you. I'm not saying it is in me, but I have seen it over the years coming out of players and people. He said it is something that comes out when the going gets tough. He spoke about a few incidents in America just about when it is tough, people have to stand up, I should say. So, like, this is interesting coming from Stockdale, from CJ Stander, the fact that Andy Farrell is buying in so much to the idea of Irishness and what it means, but in kind of a positive sense and what the characteristics are, rather than the flag-waving nationalism, perhaps, that might exist elsewhere. So I just didn't expect this angle to come up.
Do you remember how happy he was after the first game against Scotland? And he talked about, this is Andy Farrell, and everybody was like, we hammer Scotland. We normally hammer Scotland. Why is this team so crap now? And he was like, we talked to the team about having to stand for something, and they stood for grit today. It's like he's working on something very specific that builds, and then obviously it's a much easier place to build from having won a game and won another game. So you can begin to say, that stuff that we talked about, you showed that thing. And I think it's interesting that he's challenging the team to come up with what it is that they stand for, because certainly the old team last year was Joe Schmidt's team and it seemed like they were doing Joe Schmidt's stuff. This is like, who are you? In the midst of battle, who are you going to fall back on? Yourself. You're not going to fall back and look at the coach's box and go, it's like 29-0 here at halftime, what are we going to do? Like, you need to be able to internally channel something that is something that you've thought about and stand for and it's meaningful. It's exactly what we were talking about during the week, about like, what is your higher motivation?
And it seems that they're onto something here, that the Ireland rugby team and the Irishness that exists within it is actually completely the same thing as what their identity is when the going gets tough on the rugby pitch. So it's actually kind of a cool thing to read. I thought that this would be kind of a photo op and it'd be kind of one or two questions, but it seems that there's a bit more of a depth to it and the players have really taken to what Bono said. Like you mentioned earlier on about Kian Healy, and he said that there's some correlation in how they've treated their band and how you treat a team. Like he says, he was asking about U2's longevity over the time and how things stay relevant. He says he likes that answer the best. They went into the teamwork and the desire and the need for it, needing to be around each other and needing each other to succeed. Then, of course, the other big celebrity in camp this week was Paul O'Connell, CJ Stander, saying the young lads wouldn't even know who Paulie is. So, it's been a series of camps so far that have been quite positive and putting a lot of player power to the top of the priority list. Andy Farrell talking after the Wales game just about how Sexton was really leading the player meetings the day, 2 days before the game.
Yeah, which is what they're supposed to be doing all along. It was a joke, obviously, Stander, about the younger players.
Oh, obviously,
yeah. I know, just because he felt the need to go, joke. Rory and, so Rory McIlroy, Patrick Reid, what happened?
Let's start with Patrick Reid. So John Duggan had to be tipped us off about this. So on the No Laying Up podcast this week, the well-known golf podcast, former sports reporter with CBS, Peter Costas was on talking about Patrick Reid. And This for me is the most serious Patrick Reid hashtag content we've seen in terms of his professional career, at least. I know there's been stuff written about him in college, but in terms of his professional career. So this is what Costa said. I've seen Patrick Reid improve his lie up close and personal 4 times now. So he goes on to explain the situation. This is 2016. This is at Bethpage Black and the Barclays. I should state that Patrick Reid won this event by one stroke. The purse was $8.5 million. That's the only time I ever shut Gary McCord up. He didn't know what to say when I said, well, the lie that I saw originally wouldn't have allowed for this shot. Because he put 4 or 5 clubs behind the ball, kind of faking whether or not he was going to hit this shot or that shot. By the time he was done, he hit a freaking 3-wood out of there. It was a sand wedge layup originally. Just to reiterate, this is a purse worth $8.5 million that Reid won the majority of by one stroke, and there was question marks over him playing a 3-wood on a sand wedge shot. That is an incredible allegation from somebody. And he goes on to talk about the Farmers Insurance in San Diego. I was in the tower at 16 there. Reid hit it over the green and did the same thing. He put 3 or 4 clubs behind it. And it was really a treacherous shot that nobody had gotten it close all day long from over there. By the time he was done, I could read Callaway on the golf ball from my tower. Then he pointed to 2 more incidents, another in San Diego, one at the Travelers Championship in Hartford. Claims to have seen Reid improve his lie there. And then whether or not Reid actually did all this intentionally, Costa said, I'm not going to assign intent. All I'm going to tell you is what I saw. So that's pretty incredible stuff from Costas, especially the one about...
So in fairness to Patrick Reid, right, because there is a bit of a pile-on going on.
Hugely.
He is actually casting massive aspersions on Patrick Reid with what he's saying.
Massively, yeah.
And saying that he's not implying intent is actually not true. It's not true that he's not implying intent, because what's the point of putting the club behind the ball repeatedly to change a lie from a layup with a sand wedge to suddenly a 3-wood? There's clearly a point to that. Mm. It's not an accidental thing, and he's not suggesting that it's accidental over a period of time. So Patrick Reid, I'm sure, is going to be very interested to hear this, and apparently Patrick Reid is quite litigious, so I will be interested to see what Reid and Reid's camp come out and do to Costas,
yeah. Rory McIlroy as well, talking this week just before WGC at Mexico. The more I thought about it, the more I don't like it. He's saying this is in regards to Premier League golf. He says, the one thing about professional golf in my position is that I value the fact that I have autonomy and freedom over everything that I do. So he says this week is a perfect example. Some guys are going to rock up to Mexico and play. Some guys aren't going to play. I read a thing the other day, this is Rory, that said if you take the money, they can tell you what to do. So if you don't take the money, they can't tell you what to do. I think that's my thing. I've never been one for being told what to do, and I like to have that autonomy and freedom over my career. And I feel I would be giving that up to play this other league. For me, I'm out. So in proper Dragon's Den style, Rory McIlroy has distanced himself from this.
That's the end of that. The world's number one golfer says, no, you can't really set up this amazing festival of golf that's going to be everybody who is really good against everybody who's really good week in, week out, if you don't have the best golfer in the world.
But what if Tiger rocks up and suddenly plays it?
Tiger, at this stage of his career?
It would make sense for him to do so.
He's not going to be good enough to draw people in over the course. So season one, yeah, fair enough, right? But who else is coming? Who's Tiger going to play against? Tiger versus Phil? It's like, we've seen that. Did it make money? It probably did make the money.
Probably did, but it was shite. Like, I would have thought that there would be a magnetism around Tiger, that he would bring a few stragglers along. And by stragglers, I mean like Dustin Johnson, Brooks
Koepka,
Patrick Reid. I'd watch that, like, because it makes sense for Tiger at this stage in his career to perhaps get into the money making element of golf.
Yeah,
but away from his prize money.
I'm sure he's doing that already. He's doing that with his gear, and he's doing that with his building of courses. So, with more on that story a little bit later for you as well. So, what are we at? 8:15 here on OTBAM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show, broadcasting live on OTB Sports Radio. All you got to do is tell Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio on TuneIn. You can do the same on your Google Home. That's what you've got. Right, here we are. Brian O'Driscoll joined us yesterday afternoon for a 45-minute chat ahead of England-Ireland this weekend. The full chat's going to air on OTB Sports Radio today at 2 o'clock. The Go Loud app is the other best place to get that. You can get it on offtheball.com/radio. It'll also be up on our YouTube channel a little bit later on as well. But let's get into it here. Brian O'Driscoll on OTB AM. We start with O'Driscoll talking about responding to critics.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
I think professional players, in many ways, like playing with a bit of a chip on their shoulder, like to be written off. I certainly did over time, at different times in my career, where you know you're told you're beyond it or past your sell-by date. And it's a proving a point to the public, but proving a point to yourself as well, that there's you know still great years ahead of you. And I think good players have an ability to be able to bounce back from disappointment. You know, obvious thing would be Peter being benched, and many people were saying maybe it was an opportunity for Deegan to be in there or Jack O'Donoghue to be in there as well instead of Pete. But all you can do is when you're given the opportunity is to shine again, and he's certainly done that. And you'll see an integration of more players coming in over the course of the next year. It's just not the time to do it in the first two or three games of a new coach's tenure, where he's just about winning games and slowly evolving his game plan. So it's that's for November internationals, that's for maybe a summer tour where you get to try one or two things, that's for the Italy game, but it's not for for the toughest of test matches, which is definitely England at Twickenham. The first time that they're going to play in the Six Nations in Twickenham too, you know, since the World Cup as well. So there's so much riding on this as well, you know, let alone triple crowns and potential tournament wins at the end of it, you know?
Did you go looking for people writing you off? Like, was it as actively?
No, it landed on your doorstep. You know, even if you're not reading newspapers, I'd call my dad and he'd be like, oh, "Did you see what such and such wrote about you?" I was like, "No, I didn't want to see it." But you know, you can't, and your friends accidentally drop it in, going, "Sure, your man doesn't know what he's talking about." And you're like, "Go on, what did he say?"
Do you remember specific ones you're in, like, whether.
Yeah, I remember people unnecessary things. I think I remember 2013, we were 2012 maybe, we were halftime to Wales in the Six Nations. We were trailing at halftime, and I remember the RTE panelists were asked what they're thinking. What's Brian O'Driscoll thinking as he's running out here? And someone that used to work for this radio station said, well, what he's thinking here now is that he needs to really pull his socks up, because if he continues playing like that, he's going to lose all of his sponsors. And I just thought, well, that's personal. There's more to that than just a playing capacity. But when I heard that, it's not that it motivated me, but I just thought, you know, you've got to rise above that as well. But I want to constantly be able to evolve my game where people aren't in a position to be able to say those things, and just silence the critics. And whether you rate their opinion or not, it's just about not giving them ammunition to be able to come at you.
Yeah, hard to do that though, isn't it? To actually get the brain space to go, okay, I'm going to be calm about this, as opposed to when any of us have these experiences in any walk of life, is like.
Yeah, well, I think it's how do you filter that negativity as well? How do you make it a positive in your own performance? And it works. The psyche is very different, you know, from individual to individual.
Did you get better at it?
Yeah, I think I looked for it sometimes. But then at the same time, you know, if someone's saying something negatively, it's because there might be public opinion, or there might be. It's rarely just one person. So maybe there's some merit in what they're saying, but. You know, it's when they say it ahead of time where you have, you know, a poor performance which hasn't been in keeping with the way you've been playing, and you know it's made very apparent. I think it's those things where you go, you know, it was a one-off. Watch this next week, trying to put it right.
Did you find then towards the end of your career, with the advent of social media, that you would get more things directed to you? You didn't have to be rang by your dad and told who's been saying what in the newspaper. It was at Brian O'Driscoll on Twitter.
Yeah, and it's not as prevalent as back in 2013-14. Social media, as much as it was up and running, it wasn't as front and central as it
people
is.
People were still nice
these
about
days.
It. Pardon? Mm. People were still nice on
yeah,
the
yeah, yeah. It was. Like, we're still finding our feet. Yeah. You know, where all of a sudden it wasn't an opportunity for you to vent your hate and your disgust about what you've seen. And the people have always had those opinions. It's just you were oblivious to it. Mm. And it was nice. Ignorance is bliss. So I think you do learn as a player, the more mature you get as to when is a time to read papers. Some people choose not to read them at all, and some decide if they've had a decent game that it might inspire a little bit more confidence if they read some nice things about them when you've had an off game. I remember in 2012, our third test against New Zealand, I'd say arguably my worst game ever for Ireland. I knew not to go home and read anything. I just, and it was the end of the season, so it made it easier. So I didn't
60-0?
Have to evolve 60-0, yeah. And I played really poorly myself.
You weren't the only one. Perhaps.
So if there was a beauty, well, Paddy Wallace had been brought off a beach beside me and he didn't have his best game, so I'm thinking there was a pair of us in it. So, yeah, it's those things where you definitely learn. It's like there's nothing to be warranted from you know, looking at anything. And I know certain players, you know, blur out the noise. You know, I know some players during the World Cup on social media muted, you know, any voices that they thought might have tainted their view as to how they were going. Maybe some people, you know, just threw a blanket over all rugby chat and literally focused on whatever news feeds might be coming about other things, but nothing rugby based. And I think that's a smart way to go about it and just back your own opinion and let you build your own confidence and your own you know, chart as to where you need to go personally and then, you know, subsequently where the team needs to go.
And just get some outside influences who you believe and trust who are going to be able to tell you along the way. Yeah, sounding boards.
And you do have to be cocooned. You have to, you know, as much as you always are at Rugby World Cup, you've got to, I think if you start listening to the outside noise, particularly if it's negative, that can begin to infiltrate a little bit. And I think back to 07, we definitely took on board some of the pressures that were coming with.
Well, there was wild gossip.
And so little of it was true.
Yeah.
You know, I heard one where I dig the head off strings for throwing the intercept pass against Russia, because of my reaction to when the pass was given. I was like, I was pretty annoyed because we literally just talked about at halftime, don't throw any long passes because they're there for the intercept. And I think that was about 5 or 6 minutes into the second half. So I was pretty animated. But then this was rolled out to having a digging match with strings and, you know, it got
unfair,
ludicrous.
Size advantage on your side.
In fairness, he wouldn't care. So there are those things that can infiltrate if you allow them to, and I think it's more difficult to keep them at bay these days.
Did you hear that rumor around that time?
Yeah,
that came straight back into the
yeah, right. yeah, yeah. And I don't know through friends or through what I can't remember, but yeah, you know, people were. I suppose you nearly almost have to have a laugh because things were going so badly and unraveling so quickly for us. All you could do was laugh at some of the ridiculousness that was being spouted.
Yeah, because there was an email being cut and pasted and you could see all the email addresses that had it, and it was thousands of email addresses that had circulated by, and that was in the middle of the World Cup. Like, it wasn't at the end, it wasn't like months later somebody concocted these. These were the rumours that were happening. We did a great piece with Peter Mahoney last year in the build-up to the World Cup. Himself and Alan Quinlan were talking with Adrian Barry, and he talked about being paralysed almost by the pressure of the Six Nations games. That, you know, the night before in the Shelburne, you're there, and the stress was so high. And, you know, you put that together with the World Cup review where News 4 talked about the psychology being wrong and maybe we built up the pressure too much, which he had a hand in by saying that anything less than a semi-final was failure, by the way. And I just wonder about that pressure. Is that inevitable? These games are so big. There is so much riding on it. It's going to be intense pressure, the biggest pressure of your life.
Yeah, it is. I think it is. You know, I'm sure there are other situations, obviously, that are more life and death.
In real life, you know, yes.
In real life.
Yeah.
But you know, from a career perspective, it's a different sort of pressure that we're on. And it's, you know, people would argue that it's no bigger or smaller than their situations of, you know, trying to hold down a job where you're on the breadline, where
100%
you've got bills to pay. So, you know, it's relative to you as an individual, and maybe the pressures that you feel because you're in the public domain, because You know, on a Saturday, you're going to be judged by your performances, by people watching at home. Then you're going to be judged in the paper on the Sunday by journalists. And then on Monday, you're going to be judged a third time by your coaches and your peers as to what your performance was like. So that's a lot of scrutiny to deal with. And that's why some people, it's not for them. Some people come and go, and dips in form aren't just solely about the physical aspect. It's about the mental of not being able to deal with that as well. And that's why the mentally tough athletes, irrespective of their ability, physical ability, tend to go the course longer than anyone else,
yeah,
because they're able to stay in the fight and because they're able to convince themselves that that's the environment that they belong in.
He clearly is one of those guys who can do that, because obviously, you know, the Lions captain has come back from the setback of being dropped from the team. But I do wonder, like, how do you get loose? How does the team get loose ahead of this game? Like, how does he use that the night before? And how does everybody else make sure that there's no kind of contagion from him? Or if there is, it's a positive thing.
I think everyone's feeling their own pressures as well. It might not, you know, that's an individual thing to him. I'm sure some guys are very relaxed, or some guys on the facade look very relaxed, but inside they're crying. So it's you don't fully know about how different individuals are. And, you know, you could see it. I used to always love, and I've talked before about the bus journey to internationals, where at the start, you know, a couple of people were wearing headphones. By the end, nearly everyone was. And that was particularly, I used to just have a chat with Raj, because he was someone that never listened to music, but he'd be very focused, and you could see the nervousness on his face going, and I was just trying to have a laugh, because that was about expending my own nervous energy, and he'd be telling me to piss off and stop annoying him. But you know, as much as I thought it would break his nervousness a bit, but also selfishly, yeah, it was about me trying to put myself at ease. And then, you know, when Raj went, I had to, you know, stop Rob Kearney from wearing earphones, because I needed someone to talk to. I was like, I can't be the only quiet guy on the bus here. You know, there's plenty of time for seriousness when we get to the ground. Whereas now, beforehand, you know, what's the point in being tense for two and a half hours?
Yeah.
There's plenty of time, you know, to go and focus from your warm-up on, or when you get to the dressing room. But before that, irrespective of who you are, there's no point in playing the game over in your head too early.
It's interesting that you mentioned the 60-0, because if you compare, say, what happens in Ireland's relationship with New Zealand after that, it's usually positive. I'm not for one second claiming that it was 60-0 to England last year, but there is a sort of nervous energy around that this year, certainly from the supporters, about how huge a gulf there was between the two sides last year. Like, does that come into thinking when it comes to the players this week at all?
No, I think... No differently than England the previous year, you know, being well beaten in Twickenham. I think you've got a point to prove when the previous result, or the previous two results in this case, one in the Aviva, one in Twickenham in 2019, went very poorly. The second one particularly was the writing on the wall for the World Cup. The first one was the shock that maybe we weren't exactly where we needed to be going into a World Cup year. Because, you know, we just got completely overpowered, completely outthought. So I think you have to use those to your benefit, but not look back on them and use them as the sole motivation. I think teams are bigger than that these days. You're able to look at games from kind of multitude of different angles. Yes, you've got to use the emotional side, and if you don't get that right, you know, you're in trouble, particularly in big Six Nations games. But you have to think about the tactical side as well. And, you know, and trying to play each moment. So I think it'll be a combination of the two, of using the hurt from those two previous defeats, but on top of that, backing your skill level and backing the confidence that they now have after two victories to go and get the job done. And if they can marry those two, they'll be in the hunt. I'm not saying they're guaranteed victory, far from it, but they'll be in the mix.
The Guardian had an interesting line about Manu Tuilagi, saying that played five times against Ireland, won five times. Mm. It's not a bad record. Mm. What is it about this in one individual who seems to have such a power against us? I mean, obviously.
Well, that's a confidence thing too. The fact that he knows it and he said it, and there's very few English players that can say that. So, you know, certainly in the modern era, any time I see Manu Tuilagi in an England team, it kind of brings a smile to my face, except for when we're playing against them. But even still, because I know him personally, and because I know what a good lad he is, but also what a phenomenal rugby player he can be, that you know, again, finally, I got to play with him in 2013, and we haven't seen that ability for so many years. Just so to see him thrive, it does give me satisfaction. But he is, you know, almost undefendable on his day. It's the power, pace, handling, offloading combination, a bit like Vakatawa in a slightly different form, where it doesn't matter what he throws at you, it's just going to be very difficult to deal with, single-handedly in particular. So the go-forward and the momentum that he can give from an outside back is like very few others in the world. You know, Julian Sevilla on his game, and Sonny Bill isn't in that category for me. Right. He's very unique in being able to propel them go-forward. And England, you know, when they become collision winners, are a very difficult team to play against. That's their game. That's where they've always been successful.
Yeah, it almost feels like it was no coincidence that the first thing they did last year in the Aviva was accidentally throw the ball to him from a line-out, smash, and it's like, ooh, it's going to be one of those days.
And I think it was a bit about getting him an early touch as well, his first Six Nations game for 5 years. So it was about trying to get him into the game and get him, you know, get his hands on the ball and an early settler for him. And also, yeah, it's an intimidation of sorts, as this is what you should expect.
Yeah.
And I thought he was top quality. He was very good in the World Cup. And, you know, I think they look like a different team. I think a backline without him gives me a bit more confidence, particularly with Billy Vunipola not playing. If you don't have Manu and don't have Billy, I think it's a very different reflection on what their team are capable of, or complexion, I should say. Whereas, you know, you just put Manu back in, I just think that's a real string to their bow.
Johnson's saying he's fit, but how fit he is after the injury, that's the other thing. So you want to test him whenever that team is named later.
And he's not without his faults. Like, defensively, with Leicester over the course of the last year or two, he made some terrible reads, but he seems to have gotten a huge amount of that right. Maybe he's more comfortable in the current England system than he was when he was coming back, rehabilitating after injury with Leicester. But he's more than a handful.
So what do you do if you're Robbie Henshaw and Bundyaki? Do you go straight for him, test him out early?
Yeah, you close the space. You got to own that space. You let him come at you, and you know, you get back on your heels, you're in trouble. You've got to be be progressive in how you are, you know, both carry the ball, but also defensively, you got to think about chopping early, and you got to, someone like him as well, in all likelihood, he's going to try and carry his first, the first ball that he gets. So I think you've got to think as a team, depending on where he comes, you know, be it coming down the 12 channel, 10 has to jam in, or 13 has to jam in, and 10 has to have the hustle, or if he comes out to the 13 channel, you got to get help from your 12 as well. I think it's a two-man job, particularly early on. Because players want to make have a really positive early moment in a game. The last thing they want to do is, you know, throw a silly offload on the ground or shift the ball out to somebody else. It's about, how do I grow in confidence? How do I get into this game? So as soon as he gets the ball, I'd be thinking double man hit and you know, try and remind them that he's got a little bit of a niggle and he's not 100% fit, and just put that early screw into his head.
Because we had Jeremy Guscott on yesterday's OTBAM. He was talking about Robbie Henshaw was one of the players who had impressed him, and he put his hand up. You know, he mentioned the Lions and how Robbie wants to get selected for that. And Henshaw played as well in that Wales game as we've seen him in a long time, both as an attacker and as a defender. So this is a chance for him to remind everybody just how good he is, because that sense of Robbie Henshaw being a global superstar or somebody who could take Irish rugby to the next level, it dissipated a bit through the injuries over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it did. He's got no run at it. And with that, you know, I suppose creates question marks as to, obviously, beyond the durability, as to reminding people how good he can be. And when he is on the top of his game, he's a shoe-in into the side, whereas in recent years there's uncertainty because of him coming and going from the team, because there's been different combinations. He, you know, gets a run of a year or two without break, and I think he's a starter. I think he is our best defensive player in the back line, both as a tackler and as a reader of the game. So I think there's a real security that comes with that when he is in the team. The fact that he can, you know, seamlessly play 12 or 13, people might think that, you know, what's the biggie between the two? But they are quite different positions, quite different defensively. But to have him as a security at 13 of being able to read front door option, but also have the ability to react out the back. Because he's quick, but he's not as quick as Gary Ringrose. So that reactive time is, it's almost more important that he reads it earlier than Gary, because he's got to get out there to Johnny May or to, you know, whatever wingers or fullbacks are on an arcing run. So sometimes you have to, you know, you have to keep one eye but hedge your bets a little bit, and I think he's very good at doing that.
Johnny May is playing as well as anybody in World Rugby at the minute.
Yeah, I have to say, looking, you know, a few years ago he would have been sketchiness around his handling, around, you know, coughing the ball up, around what his ability to actually, you know, do other than run fast was, and he has become a very well-rounded player, almost in the Andrew Conway mould, where, but yet he's got this electric pace where he can leave people for dead. And, you know, I think you see it with the confidence in the player when they start taking against Scotland in horrible conditions, the first kickoff he took above his head. And I think that says it all about the confidence of an individual being, you know, the first play of the game. We talked about trying to, you know, remind yourself of good moments early on, and no problem, the ball didn't come brilliantly. Most players turn and catch it and brace themselves. And stupidly, actually, he caught it above his head because he got nailed by Sam Johnson, but still in the collision, you know, is able to take it. So he was a difference in you know, England getting a losing bonus point in France, and maybe that'll count for something at the end.
You mentioned the defensive prowess of Henshaw. Just to go back to defence generally, are we playing a slightly different defence now than we played in the World Cup? Has there been an evolution or a change? Was there, like, it seems as if we're slightly playing a slightly higher line. Is that?
Yeah, I think first of all, the spacings look an awful lot better. When you talk about defensive systems, you know, and I heard Stuart Lancaster talking about it, it appears what Ireland are doing versus what Leinster are doing are relatively similar. For me, the difference is that the wingers aren't playing quite as high for Ireland as they do with Leinster, and that puts a huge onus on the fullback. And maybe Conor Murray or Johnny Sexton or whoever the halfback is, to play a little bit more in the backfield as well, and give Larmour a hand with, you know, marshalling that backfield. But you know, going back to the World Cup, it looked as though we got narrow. You know, look at where we got exploited in the wide channels against Japan. I just don't think we ever had an ability to slow the ruck ball down. And defence becomes miles easier when you make it a 4-second ruck versus a 2, and it's all about positioning and all about getting more bodies to feet. I watched the game, you know, quickly again this morning from Wales, and watching the second man in tackler bouncing to their feet and pushing out into pillar or guard on the ruck, and then that having a positive knock-on effect to everyone else being able to get their spacings, get much better width. So all of those little things have a positive knock-on effect to being able to look more secure.
The spacing was something that came across from talking to Stuart Lancaster. It seemed like he's kind of obsessed with making sure that spacing is correct and the team is flat. Why is that?
You don't want to, they're not trying to drift. And the only reason that you drift, so the first, the circumstance, the ideal situation is that you get your third defender opposite the first ball carrier. That is, you know, and that's, I mean, the first ball carrier being the 10. If you bring a pod around the corner, you know, there's every likelihood that, you know, your second defender is going to hit in on it. But third defender sometimes will have to hit in on one of those forward runners as well. So put, you know, it's not hard and fast, but pretty much third defender's on first receiver. So what you want to do is put pressure on that first receiver as much as you can. I saw CJ Stander, I saw Josh van der Fleer coming out of the blocks and forcing them to make an early decision, which has a positive knock-on effect to the rest of your defensive line, because they know then that if they're going to continue playing really hard up, if he goes short, you're going to play really hard up. If he throws something wildly out the back, you know there's an opportunity for you to go a little bit softer, because the more you come off the line, the further off that defensive line, the more vulnerable you are, the more likely there's going to be a dogleg. So it's all about trying to defend as a unit then. So if they do go out the back, then all of a sudden there's a chance for you still to soften a little bit. It's when they come direct and square at you, that's when they're not thinking about drifting at all and leaving last man. If they do get to the extremity and get outside you, good luck to them. That's where your fullback then closes the gate, or the scramble, or your, you know, your blindside winger or your nine will get to a scrag on, you know, on the 5 metre channel, and that's what you're looking for. You don't want to find that situation very often, but on the occasion that it does happen, you'll survive.
And the point of that is to kind of cheat up and almost eat up the ground so that the opposition are going backwards and they're forced to kick back to you and you...
Yeah, but also what does an out-half want? He wants time to make his decision. So if you see Josh van der Vlier flying out of the blocks and giving him a second to make a decision, there's not much of a chance to think about a cross-field kick or a double dummy switch or, you know, to pick your pass. You've got to make an instant decision. And when you're forcing a quick decision to be made, you don't always pick the right option. There might be holes elsewhere, but, you know, if you have to throw your first option, that isn't always the right one to go to. I think one thing Ireland do have to be a little bit careful of, as third defender is shooting up, and particularly in Josh's case because he's trying to put so much pressure on that out half, is to not leave his second defender behind. So he has to be able to see the picture in front of him. If the 10 has a runner, particularly a winger, a blindside winger on his inside, that dog leg with second defender and third defender can invite someone into that hole. Wales nearly had a little bit of success with that. And Josh, in particular, because he's good at it, has to be even more mindful when it's a front rower, when they've just come out of a scrum and they've just, or they're on a 4 minute, you know, 3 minute defensive sequence, that it's not Tadhg Furlong or it's not Cian Healy or, you know, one of the other front rowers, where the likelihood is they're going to leave them behind. They're athletically great, but everyone suffers fatigue, particularly coming out of a scrum.
Yeah.
So
don't sell out to the tackle too much.
So you've got to be able to identify when there's that threat inside, and maybe you just come off the gas by a yard and buy your second defender a little bit more time. If there's no one on the inside, you can go harder, you can get after it because there's no option there.
Lancaster seemed to basically be suggesting that they're all from the same gene pool, that the Saracens' defence is actually really Andy Farrell's defence, and his defence is not a million miles away from Farrell, and they seems to be like a sharing of ideas almost. So we should expect that there are significant similarities between Ireland and what Leinster are doing?
Yeah. They've defended, or they've coached together for England. Of course, there's going to be similarities. And prior to the World Cup disappointment in 2015, they'd, you know, a lot of near misses on Grand Slams themselves. They won a couple of Six Nations as well with four victories, but everyone forgets that they were doing very nicely. It's just they imploded a little bit at the World Cup. So
take your points, don't kick to the corners.
Yeah. Take a draw. So, so there's no shock that they have similar philosophies. I think coaches always, and everyone that they work with, they always take the bits that they think most relevant to their own coaching style and integrate them with other ideas. And you'll see that evolution over the course of the next 10 years, particularly with Stuart Lancaster, who's still, I know he's 50, but he's still got 10 great years of coaching ahead of him at least. So, you know, he's a real student of the game as well, of wanting to siphon away different aspects of coaches that he thinks they've got some really good ideas there and amalgamate them into his style.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
All right, it's 8:44 this morning here on OTBM. Great stuff from Brian O'Driscoll there. You can hear the full interview exclusively live on OTB Sports Radio a little later on this afternoon. Best place to get that is on the GoLoud app or offtheball.com/radio, and there'll be some of it also playing on the radio tonight. Now, Tom Malone is here with us to talk to us about what's going on in the world of sport. How are you?
Yeah, we'll start with Pep and Manchester City because they've closed the gap on the leaders Liverpool to just 22 points. Kevin De Bruyne scored one and set up Rodri for a second goal in that 2-0 win at home to West Ham. City manager Pep Guardiola says he is staying at the club, though, despite the club fighting that two-year UEFA ban from European competition, which starts next season due to the financial fair play regulations.
Me personally, every case is every case, but we spoke with the players. In the next 3 months, we are still here. We're going just to focus what we have to do, and after we'll see at the end what is the sentence. But personally, no matter what's happened, I will be here.
And despite lacking a recognised striker, Tottenham will need to find an away goal if they're to earn a place in the Champions League quarterfinals. Jose Mourinho's side were beaten by 1-0 by RB Leipzig in the first leg of their last 16 tie at White Hart Lane last night. Timo Werner scored the game's only goal from the penalty spot, and Mourinho said after the game, there's still hope.
1-0 is 1-0, is not 10-0. The result is open. It's as simple as that. Wouldn't be the first team to lose a game at home 1-0 and to win the tie away. So why shouldn't we believe?
Elsewhere, Atalanta have one foot in the quarterfinals. The Serie A side were 4-1 winners over Valencia at the San Siro. There are five British sides in Europa League action this evening. Celtic are away to Copenhagen for the first leg of their last 32 tie. That gets underway at 5-6. At the same time, Manchester United kick off against Bruges in Belgium. From 8 o'clock, Arsenal are away to Olympiacos. Rangers play host to Braga and Wolves face Espanyol. Head coach Vera Pau says Áine Gorman's return to the Ireland setup will bring much needed experience to the squad. The Piemont midfielder has reversed her decision about international retirement ahead of next month's Euro 2020 qualifiers with Greece and Montenegro.
Áine could bring in a lot of experience. That is the key reason why we've asked her to be available for us. We have a few injuries. Megan Campbell, Kiva Kieran, they cannot play. They're both fullbacks, sorry, in need. And obviously, Áine can give the experience in the backup that we need.
Meanwhile, Rory McIlroy will look to get back on the horse this week after his Genesis Open disappointment last week. The world number one plays alongside Tommy Fleetwood and Gary Woodland on day one of the WGC Mexico Championship. Also in action, we have Shane Lowry and Graham McDowell as well. And there's racing later from Thurles, by the way. Yesterday, of course, this week, as you saw, I was down in William.
You were swanning around, Tom.
I was swanning around.
You were like, no, screw that. I'm not going to see the lads. I'm going to go and spend some time.
I was in my element.
Yeah, I'd say so. It looks.
Anyway, this is William Mullins talking about some of his Gold Cup hopes yesterday.
And of course, the Gold Cup, looking to retain the Gold Cup album photo. Yeah. No worse doing it's my best mate now for us.
Album photo and Ken Boy. It's very difficult for recent Gold Cup winners to get back to winning ways. Never mind, come back and win the Gold Cup. He's broken the first myth anyhow, his first run this year, his only run, he came back and won in Tremor, albeit only a grade two race, but at least he's come back and done it. So he's improving at home all the time. We've deliberately not run him, keep him fresh for the race. He goes there in great order. He loves the track, he loves the fences, everything, loves everything about it. Ken Boy has the form, Ken Boy has the rating. Ken Boy was sort of brought down to the first fence last year. Let's hope that doesn't unsettle him. Let's hope he doesn't remember it. But if he gets over the first and second and gets into a rhythm, he has every chance of getting into the first four.
Well, a couple of things strike me. He looks happy and well and in his element.
He was so relaxed. So yesterday, we went down there, right? And as you see, when I phoned into you guys, I had about 85 layers on. Like, waterproofs the whole lot. And the usual thing is they walk around in the yard, like you saw there, and then we get down to the gallops and stand there. So I had, like, Wellingtons, waterproof trousers, the whole lot. Willie comes out, starts singing us, we just go inside. And so everybody was like, and then he spoke, in fairness, for, like, 90 minutes. Went through all these 30 or so horses, about 90 minutes, as we slowly cooked, listening to him by the fire. But it was absolutely fantastic.
Sorry, my other takeaway were that I've never once seen you wear a polo neck in here, Tom. That was it's like you have a secret fashion thing going on outside of this. Dress for TV, and it's like, no, actually, the real Tom is a polo neck wearing.
Yeah, polo neck wearing, absolutely. Safety first, yeah. Safety first. I have a selection of polo necks, yeah, absolutely. You need it for the races, you know?
Yeah,
some cranberry cords as well, my tweet.
Look, we'll get back to this because we want to spend a bit more time on it, but you've got some anti-post Cheltenham bets you think we should be making.
I would, just from yesterday, I've just looked through these. They're so sweet, and Jacques and Pursois for the champion chase. I would imagine Benny Didier will go for the mare's hurdle. There's a little by the sounds of things, she'll definitely go for the mare's, and Ciel de Niege and won the handicaps for Willie as well.
All right, we will go through that in a bit more detail and spend a bit more time on that with Tom in the coming days. Now, Shane Byrne is in studio in a moment to launch the special edition legendary trading cards from Glenisk. But first, here's Andy Farrell talking to the media about how his Irish side feel about travelling to Twickenham this weekend.
I hope they won't be depressed going to Twickenham. These guys have felt a bit of success there, and I'm sure England will be talking about that as well. We're in a good place, you know. We're two from two. We know that our performance has to be better to win the England 1-1, lost one. So I suppose that this is their championship. So you would say that they would have an edge about their game. We probably need a little bit more than that as well.
Are they still hurt from the World Cup final?
Pardon?
Do you think England are still hurting from the World Cup final?
I wouldn't think so. No. They've two games under the belt. I'm sure they've addressed a few things over the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure that they're super excited about the game. He's been in all week. He's here till Friday. We like it when people come into camp. You know, we try and invite as many people as we possibly can. There's not just Paul that's been in camp this week. There's a few other guys, and we like people to try and take stock from the outside and get a feel of their feeling of how camp is. So Paul is here to observe and come into all the meetings and get a feeling, and obviously share his experience as well along the way and trying to connect with the boys.
Andy, having been both sides of the fences, how does an Ireland team win in Twickenham?
Well, you certainly need to be at your best, and we was the last time we won there. You can't go there and just hope it goes well for you. You have to go on and attack the game and do it in the right manner. And it takes a obviously a big old effort from everyone that's in the group. And you don't go to England and win on your own. You win as a collective, and that's what we've been talking about this week.
It's a very calm Andy Farrell at the press conference yesterday. Obviously, we know the team now. Kevin Dorris is going to be on the bench instead of Max Deegan. Otherwise, it's exactly the same starting 23 who are in the matchday squad. Delighted to say Shane Byrne is with us this morning. He's dropped in some Glenis goodies for us. And also, what's this, Shane?
That's a lovely mullet wig.
What's this? Who's going to try this on? Oh, and you've, this is...
This is made for you.
Well, we are sitting beside each other, Shane. It's like, it would be rude not to. I've never tried a wig of this description before. It's actually, there is so much hair here. It is a rather impractical mullet. There we go.
Hey,
it's nice and glossy.
Put it off. I did try the mullet like about 2009 before. It wasn't for me.
Oh, did you?
You had a mullet?
Inadvertently, a very, very bad barber who just kind of neglected the back of my head. But if you're going for it deliberately, obviously, it's a great thing to go for. But for me, it just didn't work.
Yeah, going for it, I just grow it and it's whatever. I've had the same lady has cut my hair since I've been 18.
Right.
And I don't say anything to her. I just sit down. She cuts.
Usual.
It's just whatever it ends up being. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
As long as it's not too short.
I was just saying to you before we went on air there, we were watching the 09 Grand Slam game back, and I had totally forgotten that Alan Wynne-Jones tried to rock the mullet as well. Yeah. What was your take on Jones's mullet? Has anybody come as close to you?
No. No, clearly not.
Clearly.
Plus it wails its gas because it comes in and out of fashion there every 4 or 5 years. You see a few of the lads trying it. And then along with moustaches and all sorts of things. But Alwyn definitely made a go out, and receding hairline probably wasn't helping. You know, you have to have a full head of hair to do it right, I think.
Yeah. What's the story with these trading cards?
Yeah, so Glenisk, who are the official yoghurt supplier for Irish rugby, they have these in their Goyo yoghurt packets. They have these trading cards. Now, they already have them with the women's team and stuff, but they're putting together a legendary set of cards. And I got wind of this, and obviously I am trying to get my own card made.
Right, yeah.
Because for some reason...
Look at number two there. It doesn't say Shane Byrne, it says something else.
No, some baldy lad, Rory Best. Well, they've all been baldy, haven't they? There's been a lot of baldy hookers. And so I have a campaign at the moment. If you go on to the Glenis Facebook page, it'll be on Twitter. I have a little campaign going where I'm trying to make myself get on to these legendary cards, you know, see, very apt there.
Hey, I get it. Like I get that. It. I get like the fun. We like puns around here.
Yeah. And so it's a campaign. There's been a lot of, it's the kind of starts from a low ebb. There's no doubt about that. And you're just going to have to tune in to see where it goes. It doesn't go according to plan at the start. It's very upsetting.
Hey, look, the path of true love never did run smooth, isn't that?
Yeah, correct.
Come here. Yeah, just while you mention it though, do you think maybe your team doesn't get it enough of the credit? Like that, actually, the team that you came through on was actually
the forgotten team.
Yeah, well, it's just a little.
It is on no highlight reels. It's on. It's hardly ever mentioned. It was one of the first sides to put the longest run streak, first triple crown since 85. There was a lot of amazing things achieved in that early 2000s. But yeah, it's been kind of eclipsed ever since.
Obviously, everything that comes afterwards, when you win a Grand Slam, that Grand Slam team is a Grand Slam team, and correct, the second Grand Slam team is a Grand Slam team.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
like they didn't just win a Grand Slam out of, you know, wooden spoon, Grand Slam. There was a building process.
Oh, there was huge, and it was a real, like, obviously the 90s were horrific for Irish rugby, in the late 90s included in that. And then there was a big, big swing around in the very early 2000s. And we started winning games that we haven't won before. And it probably started, the push started in November Internationals, where we beat Australia and we beat Argentina. Because remember, they were a big bogey side for us for a long, long time. And then the success started to go into the Six Nations, and we had a couple of good wins against England. And if you remember, we were going for the Grand Slam in that 03.
Yeah.
You know, okay, that I genuinely think that English team that beat us that day was better than the team that won the World Cup. That was their absolute peak, and they just kept that winning habit going. I thought they were absolutely amazing that day. We were up against a huge force of nature that day, but there was amazing things been achieved, victories against South Africa, and then on the way to Triple Crown, I think probably the favourite game was beating England over there.
Gavin Dempsey's try.
Yeah. And they were the world champions. First time they'd been beaten there in a while. And like, there were so many firsts and so many successes for us. But look, you know, as you say, the success that has come after it has been absolutely amazing. But yeah, there is a generation of players that you're gone in the history books. It's just not there.
Yeah, and look, I think probably with the passage of time, that generation starts to get appreciated as being part of the building blocks for what comes next. Because, like, there was a, you talk about the 90s, but it wasn't like a switch got flicked to professionalism and the team overnight became professional. But you all started to live professional lives. You all started to behave like professionals. You needed to learn the culture.
Yeah, no, it took a long time because I was one of the first that went professional. We were the first to get the contracts in the 95-96 season. Like, I'd been with the Irish squad from about 1993.
And what age were you then when you turned pro?
What would I have been? 24, 25.
Right, okay, yeah. So it's not like you come straight from school, there's an academy straight in.
I was an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and I was working, and in fact I'd just gone back to college in Bolton Street to do building services engineering and to top up.
Right.
And they offered contracts, and I was gone. And I'd been with Leinster since about 92, and it was amazing to see the Eaters. We just happened to have the perfect professional setup. So there was a lot of fight back against it in 95, 96. You know, a lot of push, the old school guys, you know, the Alec Adus weren't really fans of it. And there was a lot of resistance. And then probably that loss in 99 in the World Cup against Argentina, just going, things have to change. They really do. And everything started to go a little bit slow, but come around 2001, it really started to pick up, and there was a huge belief built in. And look, it was built on the back of monster successes in what they had been doing in the provinces, and then that Leinster trying to obviously catch up on that, and the standard was just rising and rising all the time. And a lot of the time, sure, we know there was fantastic players all through the 90s as well, but we just didn't have the belief that we could do it. Remember, it was always the last 20 minutes we would fail, and that was the biggest thing that had to change, and we started to do it.
Yeah, and that team in the noughties obviously had a bunch of kids come through who end up being the backbone of the team that wins in 2009. Look,
correct.
You know, you have talent like Brian O'Driscoll on the team.
Yeah.
He helps drive standards. Yeah. Because
O'Driscoll, Darce, Horgan, these guys saw that decade through, really, and the noughties, and just the standard that they instilled. Like, Brian himself just brought on an amazing skill set to the game. Like, he kind of single-handedly brought it that we had to bring heads-up rugby in, because you would go, normally a back would take a ball into contact, you'd have your head down about to clear out, aiming for someone to protect him, clear out, and then with O'Driscoll the ball would just
pop up
in the air, and you're okay, you got to have your head up, be ready to take the ball at any time. And, and slowly but surely, players like him, and as I said, Sean O'Brien, these guys just brought the game forward.
Yeah. Hence the legendary trading cards, and there's a good few of your teammates on that as well. This team at the moment, what do you make of our chances against England at the weekend?
Yeah, it's been odd, isn't it? Before the Six Nations, we were very much, everybody was kind of clicked into, okay, it's rebuilding, you know, we an all right Six Nations we'd be happy enough with. But here we are going for a Triple Crown. And I think the biggest thing that we have going for us is that we're very much on an uphill curve. We're improving as we go along. And England definitely aren't. And the first 20 minutes of this game at the weekend will decide, I think, the way the game goes. Because if England come out and go, right, we're first game at home, forget what came before, let's stop Ireland, and then it'd be a long, hard day for Ireland. But I think if Ireland are the opposite, if Ireland can get in, start well, which they normally have done, I think that curve will continue.
How long do you give it before Ronan Kelleher is the undisputed starting hooker for Ireland?
He just needs opportunity. It probably would have happened, this Six Nations, if he hadn't got injured just beforehand. But Herring hasn't put a foot wrong. He's doing very, very well. There's no doubt about that. So I would say you're probably looking at November Internationals or something like that, or tours, because...
Ideally, they'll have a rivalry now, that he'll improve.
That's what you want.
That Herring has stepped up. I've been very impressed by Herring.
But that's the key to it. Herring has stepped up. The standard that Herring has been playing at to this point, to get him onto it, he's risen again in this Six Nations, you know, which is fantastic to see, because he knows that this kid is on the bench. And everyone knows that once he eventually gets with that jersey on his back, he won't let go of it. And that's the thing that Herring has stepped up superbly. And that's what you want. That's what competition drives within squads. And like, sure, you can see Standard is a huge example of that. Like, he's been outstanding. But there's no doubt it's because Doris is chomping on his heels.
Mm. Gordon Darcy was making the point yesterday that it suits Ronan Kelleher actually in a high pressure game at Twickenham to come off the bench at the same time as someone like Devon Toner. It just helps you with that first throw.
Yeah, no, it does. And like, I'd say you could lay a hefty bet that that's where the first throw will go. But it is great for him, and that's what, and you know, for his longevity and for him to get to achieve the standards that we know he can, it's probably good it's happening this way. You know what I mean? Good few caps coming off the bench, you know, a bit of stability, as you're saying, with Toner and stuff, that we can see that everyone doesn't go, write him off, like he's had a couple of howlers because his mind just wasn't right. That there's a great opportunity for him now to build a really stable footing that he can build a huge international career on.
You had that rivalry with Keith Woods, where he was the incumbent for a long period of time, and because he was the captain, it was going to be very hard to shift him out of the team anyway. But eventually, you do manage to shift him out of the team. That rivalry was fractious at times, right? You were poking the head off each other a couple of times.
Yeah. Loved every minute.
Did you? Yeah,
absolutely. But that's the way it goes. Like, the, you know, Keith was. I wasn't just competing against Keith, the player, which he was amazing. He's one of the best footballers that played in the country. And, you know, but I was against the whole aura that was Keith, the captain, the leader, you know, the machine that was behind him. So it was a hard, hard battle. But look, I wouldn't change a thing of it.
What's that like? Like, at times, are you thinking, this isn't going to happen for me because there is an aura? And like, so he'd led the team on and off the field, taking them on strike and all sorts of stuff.
Unfortunately, it wasn't just Keith. It was 8 years. Like, I was in the Irish squad in 93, first captain 2001, and there were a lot of hookers there. I was twice told to get my hair cut.
Didn't. By who?
Didn't. Dropped. Noisy Murphy. didn't and was dropped. And, you know, towards the end of the 90s, yeah, I was getting very concerned. I thought I'd missed the boat. Really
were you playing well? Did you feel like you were playing well and deserved
a
place?
Yeah, look, like everyone, it was up and down. But I was consistently on Leinster, bar a few ups and downs. I was playing in Leinster the whole time. And, you know, we were going well. And I just had to stop. I had a bit of a revelation moment with an old Grizzly coach called Joe Mack. And he told me to cop on. And he said, look, you know, stop worrying about the things you can't control. Because I was all about, oh, they won't pick me, they. So I just made myself as good as I can possibly be, that if opportunity knocks, I'd be ready. And thankfully, within 9 months, it did. And the glamour fixture of away in Romania was gave me my first cap.
But like, I specifically remember a gale force wind against Australia where I think we'd 9 lineouts and you hit 9 out of 9, and we won that game. And that was like a massive turning point for us. I'm not sure what year that is, but
That's 2002.
It's 2002. That period, we played amazing rugby all the way through.
Yeah.
And it's the first game.
We'd 11 wins in the trot or something like that. You know, it was great. And like, that's when I was talking about earlier on, that we were starting to set the standards and that we wanted to achieve.
But that didn't happen from you whining about not getting picked. Something, that bit.
But that, no, you see, that was.
That level of proficiency didn't just come from.
No. And like, that's. that was a change of mindset about everything about myself. And, you know, late 90s in a very, very dark place. And just because of that conversation with the coach, I copped on and I just fixed everything. And if there was any quirks in throwing, and I changed my attitude to throwing, and it kills me now the way the throwing is, that the hookers, they could hit a fly from 50 feet going up a wall in a straight line. But sometimes you're in control of that ball until the last time it leaves your hands. You're in control of it. So if you see that they read it, they've read where you're throwing the ball, you can push it higher and that it comes up and drops. Where everything now is speed. It's quick movement on the ground and it's just speed. Meet up the top and then down. Whereas if someone reads that, you've got to change your throw. You've got to be able to arc the ball. And a lot of guys just can't do that now, you know, and if someone gets up in front of them, they can't adjust, which is, it's a shame, because there's a lot to throwing. It's not just, you know, chucking the ball, and you can always, and it was changed, it was different for me as well, because I called every line out I ever threw into,
right?
So I knew what I could or couldn't do, and I knew where, as much as myself and Paul O'Connell used to have quite lively debates, as you can imagine, about calling. But like, we had a very successful lineup because I had a Mays and jumpers to throw to, like as a Dunica, Paul, Mallow Kelly, obviously, who I would have worked with more than anyone else. But they knew that, they trusted me, that if they saw the defender was up beside him, if they stayed in the lift and they leaned back, that gave me another yard,
right,
to push the ball. And they knew that I'd get it to them.
Now it's timing and tempo.
But now it's just speed, because if someone comes up beside you, the ball is still going to be in the same place, whether that guy was there or not. That's not, because you're in control.
So you think that there should be more opportunity for the thrower to change his mind?
They should
the trajectory.
Develop the way they throw. You know what I mean? It shouldn't. They're amazingly accurate. They're amazing accurate. It's an amazing skill that they have to be able to hit that little tiny target. But there's more to it than that.
We've got to go. You've been great with your time. But who's going to win this weekend? What happens?
Yeah, well, look, as I said, the very early starts of the game, I'd love to be able to tell you straight after 20 minutes. I do think that that'll dictate it. Whoever wins the first 20 minutes will win the game. I don't think it'll change an ebb and flow throughout, because that'll either be continuing Ireland's improvement curve and England's woes, or else England are back at home. And it's going to be a very, very hard day.
We've seen that movie before, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah. Best of luck getting your card. How do people
thanks.
Support you
yeah,
in your
so
endeavour
yeah,
to
get onto
best
the website,
off?
Their Facebook pages, Twitter. It's a very, very hard campaign, and I had to do a lot of embarrassing things to make it happen.
Well, best of luck with it. Shane Moore was in the studio this morning. With thanks to Glenisk, official yoga partner of Irish Rugby, as they launched their legendary trading cards. The Shot Clock is still to come this morning with Kieran Donaghy. John Duggan is in the studio next with Virtual Insanity. Stay tuned. OTB AM. 9 minutes past nine this morning. We've still got the Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy to come. But first, it's Thursday morning, which means it's time for one thing, Virtual Insanity with John Duggan.
And good morning, everybody. And the pot is 922 entering this week's golfing fair. The WGC Mexico Championship and the Puerto Rico Open happening both today. So we're going to split our money this week, our €20 virtual cash, right? So the first bet, you got to be bullish. You got to be sticking with Rory McIlroy. Okay, the triple bogey of the Genesis Open last week in Los Angeles. But Rory McIlroy, five top fives in five starts. His form is outrageous. His PlayStation golf from Rory McIlroy. He's going to win this week, right? He's been seventh and second in this tournament in the last couple of years in Mexico. He didn't play in 18, but he played in 17 and 19, right? So last year, he was second behind Dustin Johnson. It was a five-shot win for Johnson, but then another five shots between McIlroy and the rest of the field. McIlroy, absolute cert to be in the top five here, right? So we're looking at quarter of the odds, the first five places with one of the bookmakers. You got to shop around. You got to gamble responsibly here. Rory McIlroy, five each way at 6-1. He's going to win this week. Simple as that. Really enjoyed his press conference yesterday. A guy who's confident about his game, Rory McIlroy. But always 67 in the field. You want to go for an outsider. Rafael Cabrera Bale, of course, from Spain, 80-1. For three each way, fifth of the odds for seven places. Rafael Cabrera Bale has got form in this tournament. 38th, 3rd and 19th. Three starts in Mexico.
He's finished in the top 20 in Los Angeles last weekend in the Genesis Open. Has played well, started the year well in Abu Dhabi. Doesn't win that often on the European Tour. But Rafa Cabrera Bello, a very good ball striker, course form and decent enough recent form. I think he's a tasty price at 80-1 to reach the frame. So Rory McIlroy for the win and Rafa Cabrera each way in the Mexico Championship. The Puerto Rico Open is also on this week for the lesser known golfers, a bit of down in grade. And they say in horse racing, sometimes if you drop in class, you got a better chance. Kiride Abibarnrat, the Thai golfer, last year was third in Mexico and he was fifth previously. This week he's playing the Puerto Rico Open at Cocoa Beach. I'd love to be there, but I'm not. He's 60-1. He's never seen the course, but in a tournament with a lesser field, with players that are not as good as Mexico, at 60-1, I think he's worth two each way. So Kiride Abibarnrat in the Puerto Rico Open for two each way. Rory McIlroy to win in Mexico and Rafa Cabrera Bello each way in Mexico. Never gamble more than you can afford. Always gamble responsibly. This is Virtual Insanity. Back next Thursday to look at the camera here and tell you who's going to win the golfing tournaments. Also, you can check out the tips and more of an explanation from yours truly on offtheball.com.
Good stuff, John. Thanks very much for that. No hitting the crossbar this week. The sound of those golf tips is the exact same sound that Erling Haaland's shot made during the week. That's what's going to happen for you on Sunday evening. Last night, we've heard Andy Dunn with Will Greenwood together on Wednesday Night Rugby, and it's not the first time that they've been together. Have a listen.
I think I'm going to interrupt there.
So Will Greenwood was talking to the game, going, done a drift because it's your tackle, or done a there's a try on, give me the ball, or done a boot it. Because we're in trouble. That was, but by that stage, you've got the absolute worst of me, the verbose English bloke who was by this stage 31 years old. Both his shoulders are dropping off, and I was literally just trying to survive. So, talking people through the game just to try and make sure the ball either came near me if there was loads of space, or came nowhere near my postcode if it was surrounded by okay. wasps or tigers.
So self-preservation was his motivation. What was your experience of it, Andrew?
It was an extra pair of ears and eyes. A channel wider. And certainly as a young fly half, I didn't have the presence of mind to run a game well enough. I was instinctive and that had its benefits at times, but I didn't have the capacity to control a game like many good fly halves and international level fly halves could. So Will would effectively, the phrase I would use is, would tell the story of the game out loud as it was happening, which I think to maybe some of the Irish public it looked like I had grown as a player and learned, where in fact I was making the right choices with a bit of help coming in my way. So it was being filtered in. And
Dunner was the original Carlos Spencer. He was the original Freddie Mishalak. Wasn't quite sure when to take the sensible option. So I was just the old sensible bloke. Like, you know those two Muppets in Sesame Street up in the theatre? Just sort of guffawing along, saying, I just tried to keep a rein on his free-flowing rugby spirit.
The Six Nations Show on OTB Sports Radio.
The evolution of Ireland probably wasn't to the same degree over that period of time.
Updates, analysis and opinion across all OTB channels from start to finish.
I'm kind of sick of listening to them saying, it's because they're the biggest playing pool in the world.
Gone on it!
I've never seen a team like Ireland before.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
The Six Nations Show on OTB Sports Radio, Thursdays from 12.
We support the Irish.
OTB Sports Radio, live, online, 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
You are very welcome along to this week's Shot Clock. It is the Irish broadcasting version of Liverpool against Atletico Madrid, where we put the famed classy talents of Kieran Donaghy up against the shithousery of Gerard Gilroy. The format is simple. We've got three different rounds. First of all, we've got the classic Shot Clock. We've got a couple of debate subjects where Ger and Kieran go up against one another. If they make a good argument, you will hear this sound. It's just a bing, basically. And if they don't make a good argument, it's the opposite of a bing. It's that precise sound. And it's 1 point for a good argument, 1 point against you for a good argument. After that, we'll get into Kieran's free throw, where he talks about whatever he wants to talk about, basically, this week. And then into our picks, which have been nip and tuck so far. If anybody's got any suggestions for the forfeit at the end of this year's Shot Clock, please get in touch. The best suggestion still so far is Naked Broadcasting from the loser. Kieran Donaghy is on the line this morning, and we're starting off with topic one, which is the fact that there is a job going in the midfield for Dublin. We know that Brian Fenton is the generational talent in this position, the best player in his position in the country right now, but there is still technically a vacancy beside him. Nobody has managed to lock down that other jersey. Kieran, for the next couple of years, who should partner Brian Fenton in Dublin's midfield?
I would put Brian Howard in there. I think they're both Raheny men. Fenton's 25, 26 now. I think Howard's 23. They've got a great bond, obviously, as club players. They have a great understanding from the club scene as well as the county scene. I think Howard's fantastic in the air. If you look back to the time Kerry put the press on him last year in the first All-Ireland final, it was Howard that had that magnificent catch over Gavin White and led Dublin down the field for that goal that really set them off. I think he's played a lot at centre-back in the league, so he's a great understanding of what a defence needs from a good midfield partnership in an 8 or a 9. So I think he'd have a good understanding to drop back from there as well. Obviously, he's played a lot at half-forward, a lot at centre-back, and really, his all-round football ability, his quality on the ball, he's a great kick passer, he can take a score, he knows how to help his defence. I really think he's the perfect partner for Fenton in the middle of the field, and I would go with him all day long.
You're wasting the talents of one of the greatest footballers of all time, potentially, in Harrod. Harrod has a pirouette that we've never seen the like of. He's got the balance and the running ability to run a game from centre-back. Because you already have a generational talent in midfield, and you can supplement him with a range of different players. Michael Darren McCauley is not finished. Patrick Cuffey-Byrne is an animal, according to Brian Fenton. That's what he told Owen last week. The point is that there are millions of different potential constellations of what could work in midfield. And I think we have not even scratched the surface of what Harrod can do. I think he is literally somebody who can play in any of the six forward spots if you need him to. But actually, his best position may well be at centre-back running games. When you think about the type of possession
Dublin
football that they're going to have to play.
John Small and James McCarthy, why would you be putting a fella like Brian Howard at centre-back when you've got John Small or James McCarthy?
John Small is just a marker at this stage. John Small has yet to become somebody who can actually read the game the way, for example, Keane O'Sullivan has done. But Brian Howard, absolutely. He can do that. He can get forward for scores. Or, better still, you can pick him left half forward and he's going to be the best left half forward in the country for the next 10 years.
Why can't he be the best midfielder in the country, though, and just put him in a slot next to his own club, man, where you're right, he can dictate games from centre-back. Do you know what? He can dictate him better from midfield.
Darren Gavin.
He's more freedom out there. I know they've got options.
Darren Gavin, Patrick Cuffey-Byrne and MDMA are all going to be there already. So you're actually solving a problem that doesn't need to be solved. We're only talking about this because Dublin have so many good forwards. But his ability to drop deep when they need to fetch catches, as you've said, you can do that from the half forward line. His running ability suggests that he's going to be an auxiliary midfielder anyway, no matter where you pick him. But I just think that what you want is him not to be overshadowed by his midfield partner and not to be markable the way midfielders are. So you don't want Kerry, for example, to be able to go, Jack Barry, your job today is to take him out of the game. You want to make sure that he's going to have a bit of freedom either as that centre half-back who holds things and starts plays or in the forward line where he's given a completely free run to do whatever he wants.
Yeah, of course. Can you play him at centre-back? Can you play him at wing-forward? You can. I think he'd benefit massively from being given a set position and being told you're our guy. Now maybe Patter or Cuffey-Byrne is the man. Maybe it is Darren Gavin, but I don't know. They're unproven, whereas Howard is proven. You have 5 in a row in the bag. You're trying to get 6, 7, and 8, and you go with your 2 best players in the middle of the field, 2 club men. And
20 seconds, lads.
I think they could form an absolute scary partnership in the middle of the field, the two of them. They both can move, they both can cover for each other, they're both unbelievable on the ball. And it's hard then to just put a Jack Barry on one guy, because if you put a Jack Barry on Howard to keep him quiet, then Fenton's going to murder you. You put your marker on Fenton to keep him quiet, then Howard is going to cause you trouble.
All right.
Go with your 2 best guys in the middle of the field.
A lot of contradictions going on there, lads, I'm not going to lie. Jerry, you're on -3. Kieran, you're on +1 at the moment. ridiculous. Like, what is freedom? What is an auxiliary midfielder, really?
He said he could play anywhere in the 6 forwards. I don't know if Howard's going to be inside full forward anytime soon.
And then you can pick him corner forward anytime you want.
Yeah, you could if you want to send him out the middle of the field as a third midfielder, which is making my point.
Let's move on to topic number 2. It is the NBA All-Star Weekend. You're a big fan, Kieran.
Yeah, look, it was absolutely sensational, to be honest with you. And, you know, I had an issue, and Jerry kind of brought it up last week in Shot Clock, and the issue was that this game was becoming a joke. It was becoming a highlight reel, nobody making any effort, nobody really interested in the game. It was losing its appeal big time, and same as the Pro Bowl in the NFL, and somewhat same as even the GA All-Star games, they've lost their appeal. But I think the NBA resurrected it big time this year. It was Team Giannis versus Team LeBron, like it's been for the last 3 years in a row. But what they did is they got two brilliant charities on board. They played each quarter as its own separate game. So what you have then is automatically competitive guys that want to win each quarter. 100,000 was given to the winner of each quarter. LeBron won the first, Giannis won the second. The third was an unbelievable tie at 41 apiece. And then to honour Kobe Bryant, 24 points was added on to the top scored at the end of the three quarters. So LeBron's team were on 133, and you put 24 into that, and the top score was 157. So basically turned into the first to 157. And what you had is you had two teams going at it. They went down to the final stretch. It was 155 each. And it was inevitably, it was next score wins. There was fouls. There was more free throws than ever before in an All-Star team. There was defense. You had Giannis going against LeBron. You had Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook. You had guys going at each other that we haven't seen in it for a long, long time in the All-Star game. Kawhi was the man, MVP, the first Kobe Bryant All-Star award. He got his 30 points. And you know what? It's fitting because he's the most like Kobe in the NBA right now is Kawhi Leonard. And that was... That was a huge thing, but it was brilliant. And maybe another tweak for next year. Why am I getting the NBA?
I can just stay strong here. And
elaborate on this here.
It's him.
Why am I getting a negative point for Kawhi Leonard being the most like Kobe in the NBA right now?
Is he? I'm not sure if I go along with that, Kieran. Back that up. Where's your evidence for that?
You're not in this. You're the ref. Put me back over to my colleague. He is the most like Kobe Bryant in the league. He's similar size. He's a two-way player. He's the best defender in the league right now. Kobe was a completely unheralded defender. He was a beast on defense. And I think body language-wise, in-game-wise, they're both tigers when the games are on the line. We saw that last year when Kawhi led his Raptors, who were massively unfancy, to win the NBA championship. So he was well-deserving of the Kobe Bryant. A little tweak for next year, something that would be interesting, would be making it a team world versus a team USA.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll give you the starting fives for both. USA, Steph Curry, Kawhi Leonard at the two, LeBron at the three, Durant at the four, and Anthony Davis at the five, which is scary. But when you put them with Ben Simmons at the one for the world, along with Luka Doncic at the two, Wiggins at the three, Giannis at the four, and Embiid, Jokic or Gobert at the five, it would be unbelievable. And I think your competitive edge would be absolutely driven through the roof if it was a world versus the USA in every All-Star game.
The Olympics should do that instead and just go, look, we understand that the Dream Team is going to win every gold medal, so what we're going to do is have a rest of the world in the Olympics. Can I ask a question here? Like, are there lessons that we can learn for Irish sport? Because we're essentially talking about GAA here, and there is no... There's no window in the calendar. Like, the weekend of the All-Ireland final would be great if on the Friday night Croke Park was full and it was a tenner in and you had some kind of All-Star occasion. But those players who are playing in that game will actually end up missing club matches to do that and or risking injury for a club match. So the time of the year doesn't really work. Is there any window where we could actually get the best players involved in something that would help promote the game, that would just give a different audience the opportunity to do it and try new things, have kind of some weird combine superstars thing going on, like something just to sex the whole weekend up?
I just think you're fighting an uphill battle, because as much as guys would love to be nominated, one, you have to be kind of nominated for an All-Star, so I think all your nominees... The problem is on All-Ireland final weekend, probably half of those nominees are playing the following day. And then you have what you have left over, you probably don't have enough for a proper game. And you are, as you rightly say, running the risk of injury, running the risk of players not getting it. Maybe you could have, look, there's going to be Tier 1 and Tier 2 this year. Maybe you put a Tier 2 All-Star game with the best players from that tier on the day before. But it's going to be really hard. Like, they're trying to incentivize the All-Star game by bringing in abroad to make the All-Stars want to go and play a game. But maybe when they do bring it abroad, maybe they actually kind of do it at a time of year, like it's in November or whatever, and you kind of say to the teams, look, listen, lads, we're going to go at this today for, you know, we won't try and hurt anybody, but we're going to play a proper game, which is all you want.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to pick up injuries. Fellas can get injured at training for a club.
Four quarters.
You know, that can happen.
Four quarters is a great idea because it means that the scoreboard resets and everybody goes, oh, geez, okay. But actually, it lends short-term excitement up against the clock. Everybody gets competitive up against the clock, as we know on Shot Clock, Kieran.
Yeah, no, 100%. That would definitely be a good idea. But they should certainly look at something because our great players that win these All-Stars or even get the honour of being nominated for an All-Star, that game deserves to be maybe on national television, which I know when it goes abroad, I'm not sure it is. Yeah. I think it's very much a kind of we'll promote the game around the world. But if you're going to promote the game around the world and you're going to bring All-Stars out to foreign trips, well, then you need to put 2 or 3 months of advertising into where it's on. You need to get into the Irish community over there. You need to pack a little stadium out. Yeah. You need to make it 13 against 13, whatever it may be, to have that. Kind of,
dangerous territory there. You're talking about Super 11s.
I'm just talking about what's the possibility of getting a GAA-sized pitch in one of these stadiums.
Impossible.
Come
yeah.
on. Turning
a glorified holiday into an all-star, competitive game.
15 in the soccer pitch.
Turning a glorified holiday into a competitive all-star game. Deducted you 1 point, and I can tell you Gerard's closing the gap considerably. He's only on -1. Kieran, you're on
That's
like one
joke.
Or two. Topic three, Kieran, it's about shithousery. Atletico Madrid, I thought perhaps it was an excellent defensive performance from Atletico Madrid that helped them beat Liverpool on Tuesday night at the Wanda, but a lot of people are referring to their shithousery and to their dark alley tactics. Is shithousery a prerequisite to success at the moment?
Yes, you absolutely 100% need a degree of it. If you go back over any of the great teams that have won anything, you have to have your guys that are going to get in your faces, and Atletico have a lot of them. I know they lost Godin last year, but you know, you have to be in people's faces at the highest level. Now you have to try and rattle their cage. You can't just take them on in football and hope that's good enough, and it will be good enough. But when the thing gets very tight and you're playing a team that are really up for it and you've got guys in your faces, if they can take you out of your game, you know, I experienced it with that great Tyrone team. You know, I have Joe McMahon rolling in my face. I look over, Tommy Walsh is getting it I'm getting it from Justin. Tommy's getting it from Joe. And what they're trying to do is take you away from concentrating on the ball and get you rattled. And you look,
did it work?
Of course. It did in essence, because what it did is it didn't allow us to run around and play this beautiful free-flowing game that we had in our heads going into an All-Ireland final. Now you're in an absolute complete dogfight. Now you had to deal with dealing with a very stubborn defence, a lot of bodies around you. And then every time you turn it over, there's fellas in your ear, there's fellas hopping off you. The level of frustration builds up, your anxiety builds up. You're in front of 85,000 people, you're in front of your family, you're trying to win for your country, your county. So of course it affects you. And I think the Dublin team now are a prime example. Your John Smalls, your Phillies, you know, these guys are in your ears and they're really ratcheting up that side of it, as well as being fantastic athletes, as well as being unbelievable defenders. Like Johnny Cooper's an unbelievable defender. He's all the science behind it. He puts in all the hours, but he's getting in your ear when he turns you over. He's been physical with you. He's bumping off you. He's trying to upset your rhythm and flow in a game. A forward loves nothing better, or an attacking team loves nothing better than to come out and just play the game and nobody say boo to you.
I think
what Atletico did the last day to Liverpool is exactly what probably more teams need to try and do in the Premiership, which is really, really get stuck into them.
I think the key thing about this is that it's actually, at a fundamental level, it is coached in the best teams. That Liverpool themselves have their own art form of shithousery, and that's tactical fouling. Manchester City, exactly the same. If you look at the stats for where they foul, they mostly foul in the opposition third of the pitch, top third of the pitch, because that means that when they're getting turned over, they're having a foul and they're making sure that the defence gets set again. That, to me, is like raising the level of shithousery to an arch level. And it's clear that Tyrone, for all their protestations, there would have been conversations. It might have been off-Broadway. It might not have been, you know, at the team meeting in front of the 32 people and the 600 selectors and the backroom teams. But if you look at what Dublin did at the end of that All-Ireland final a couple of years ago, when Mayo were looking to kick out the ball and everybody wrestles people to the ground, don't tell me a conversation was not had about that. Don't tell me that 5 or 6 people had exactly the same instinct at the final seconds of that game. That is the level that the top teams are operating at. And if other teams don't appreciate that, They're not in the same ballgame. You think back to the All Blacks after we beat them in Chicago. They came and they took the heads off. They literally almost took Henshaw's head off. There were two other players who went out of that game concussed because they decided they were going to beat the crap out of us and that they were going to make friends with the referee before the game. He warmed up in their corner. They were all over shaking hands at Jaco Pyper. He refereed that game easy. They could have had a couple of yellow cards, certainly could have had a couple of red cards, and didn't in the end. We ended up losing that game because we weren't playing at that level. They were playing chess, we were playing checkers.
Yeah, no, if you look at what you're saying, you're 100% right in a way, because if teams are going to go right to the edge of the line to win, and modern sport, no, nobody remembers second place. It's really you get nothing for it. It's win at all costs, and if you want to win at all costs, you have to take it to that level. Is it being coached? Absolutely. Have the Dublin teams and the Tyrones and the All Blacks? They have all that, but you know what else they have? They have the unbelievable players. They have the unbelievable athletes that help you win the game. If you go out there and you don't have those athletes and you don't have those unbelievable players,
Liverpool and City do as well. Exactly, yeah. Yeah,
You got. But if you can marry, which is what the best teams are doing, like what this Dublin team are doing at the minute, if you can marry that athletic ability, that unbelievable skill level, and the small bit of shithousery, You're on a winner.
One last point. I'm very surprised that Kerry needed lessons from Tyrone. I don't understand how that happened. Like, surely you guys are at this in club matches to each other all the time. You just forgot to bring it to Croke Park that one day.
No, not really, man. It really isn't something that's done in Kerry. It's you know.
Tell David Clifford that.
We've got a.
We've
got a winner.
It might be leaking down to us.
We've got a winner here. Jer has finally claimed a shot from
Croke. I can't believe it.
I will say, Kieran, the nobody remembers second place line did you in there. We talk about Mayo more than any other county on this show. It is the very antithesis of your point. Just one final point before we move on to your free throw, Kieran. What is the worst case of shithousery you've ever encountered? There's no points being scored here. This is kind of a separate free throw almost.
I would say it was the 08 final. It was brilliant by Mickey Hart what they did. It was, you know, I heard rumblings that Joe McMahon would be coming from wing forward back on top of me, and then he jogged back towards me, but then he went over to Tommy Walsh. Justin was on me. You'd Conor Garmley, you'd Ryan McManaman, you'd Philly Jordan, you'd absolutely the cream of the crop when it came to shithousery. what you had also is unbelievable players, and you know, Philly Jordan and Garmley were unbelievable out in the half back line. Ricey was in one corner, Justin was hopping off of me, Joe was hopping off of Tommy. Saying that, it was 2008, we were in the game, we gave away an unbelievable sloppy goal after half time, which inevitably caught us, and Sean Kavanagh took over when the game was on the line. But you know, when I talk about shithousery and I use Ryan McManaman as he'll put his hand up himself. He knows he was the king of it. When we played him in Killarney in 2012, when we beat Tyrone well in Killarney that day in the championship, and it probably marked the end for a few of those lads.
Oh.
And I have the utmost respect for McManaman in a way, because he kept coming. He kept coming with the verbals, even when Kerry were 6-7 points up in Killarney. We were in our pomp, the green and gold, the sun was shining. There was 40,000 in the stadium. And he kept at it and kept at it right until he got sent off. And he was even jiving at me going off the pitch. And my respect levels went up for him, because it's easy to do. It's easy to be at the shithousery when you're winning and you know you're affecting the opposition. But when you know you're not affecting the opposition and they're absolutely tanking you and you're still full of shithousery, I got to take my hat off to Ryan McManaman.
That is dedication.
Commitment.
To the craft. Let's move on to the actual free throw today, Kieran. You've been chatting about social media this week and perhaps the damaging effect it can have on sports people, and that, I guess, is accelerating in recent years. What's your take on this? Do you have any personal stories on the whole social media aspect of being an intercounty footballer?
No, look, I was asked the question at the launch for Laker Gale on Tuesday, and look, it kind of came out that I was suggesting that the GAA is going to solve the whole thing. It's obvious that the GAA is not going to solve the trolling issue, you know. And I'm not saying people don't have free speech. All I'm really saying is people should have accountability for what they say and what they say on people's pages, on certain forums, and when they target people on social media. You know, if I'm on Sky Sports or I'm on Off the Ball, if I say something, I have to be accountable. It comes back to me. People are allowed to come back and go at me on it. But But I think this you know, a pseudonym accounts on social media, you know, I mentioned the forums that each county have. I have no problem with people giving their opinion on forums, but you must put your name to it. You can't put some random BBB444 and slate all around you. Like, it's the biggest act of cowardism that you can ever do. You know, and I only heard yesterday that Mary Butler, that I think she was Fianna Fáil, a TD, there was a Facebook, a fake Facebook page set up that was pretending to be her, that liked very wrong material, inappropriate material. And then when that was stopped and that Facebook closed down that page, they still had all the screenshots and they were banging them around on WhatsApp. So it's just a very dangerous area. And I think, you know, if anybody's looking for the blue tick on Twitter, if you get over, I think it's 10,000. Hillary did it for me when the numbers were on the social media accounts. But you have to give your passport. You have to send your details. You have to send two forms of ID. And Twitter will do that for anybody that gets over 10,000. So Twitter, no problem doing it for the big names out there to verify them. But they won't verify the person that has 15 followers, but that actually is causing a lot of harm on social media. Now, obviously, it's a cost implication for them. Obviously, they have to bring on more people to do all the paperwork and get through all of that. But we need to do something. Something needs to be done. And maybe the GAA could use funds maybe to educate young players in all these development squads around the country, maybe to show them how to handle it. It never really bothered me. The trolls never really bothered me. I took it for what it was. I took it that if they were going to put that up on their page, they're clowns anyway. But some younger people mightn't be able to do that. And maybe the GAA could invest in some money, maybe look at getting the amount of people that go around the country to these development squads and talk to them about social media, warn them about the pitfalls, warn them that if they're sharing and liking material on WhatsApp, how that can affect other people. If they're on Snapchat, if they're online bullying, the dangers that can have for both them as a person when they go on and say they're 17 or 18, they're trying to get a job in a few years and somebody goes back through their Facebook or their Twitter profile and sees stuff like this going on, they'll be ruled out of a job straight away. The effect it's having on the person that you're going after, you know, that's a huge thing. And there's a part of me as well that, you know, when I talk about it in my camp, I talk about it, I do it in my basketball camp every Easter and Halloween. I talk to the kids about bullying and online bullying. But I also talk to them about resilience. And I think that's a big thing that we can try and go towards with the kids is how to be resilient about this, and that if people are having goes off you on certain forms of social media, to how to try and teach them to be more resilient. And, you know, that, look, ideally in a perfect world, yes, there's no more trolls, there's nobody giving you grief on social media, but we're not in the perfect world, unfortunately. And I think trying to show the kids maybe how to be more resilient. And look, I'm not an expert, so I you know, I don't have any areas of expertise in this field. I just know when I'm talking to the kids at my camp, I know they take it better coming from me rather than a teacher or a parent. And all I try and say to them is never be a part of it. Just have a think before you post something up about someone. And you know what? With all the stuff we try and get the kids to do, the adults are the biggest issue here. There's people there that have accounts and that they have kids themselves and they're abusing people online. And I would wonder, what would they think that if a few years somebody was doing that to their kids, how would they feel about it? So I think we all need to take a big step back when it comes to social media and realize, and listen, I use social media for my own benefits, for PST, my company. We do a lot of retweeting for them. But you can't justify what some people say, and it has to be people have to step up and rise above it and really start looking at what they're doing. And if people are opening accounts from now on, even if Twitter can't go back over everybody else that's on Twitter from now, even if they said, if Twitter and Instagram said right now we're going to get everybody to, they have to send on an image of their passport, an image of their name, and that name has to go on the account. And I think that's a huge thing that we should do. Instagram accounts and Twitter accounts, they should have to use their mother's passport so that there's linkage. So if they're doing online bullying or they're saying inappropriate stuff, that Twitter can get onto the parents and say, listen, we're going to close this account and you can have a chat. And there has to be more accountability in the world of social media. And the big Facebooks, Twitters, Instagrams, Snapchats, they all have to step their game up. I'm not for one second suggesting that the GAA are going to start this. The only thing I said about the GAA is, could they figure out a way to try and help people deal with it? Yeah. And I said they should shut down the forums. maybe they shouldn't shut down the forums, but maybe need to make sure that everybody on the forum has a real name, a real ID, and we know where they're coming from. Yeah. And that if they're going to be saying something about managers, players, or individuals, that they can be held accountable afterwards.
All right, that is the free throw this week. Moving on to the final section of this morning's Shot Clock. We're getting into the picks. So last week, it finished 1-1 in the pick section. You both picked Team LeBron in the All-Star game. Galway against Tip was called off. And you were both wrong about Chelsea versus Manchester United, because United surprised a lot of people by beating Chelsea on Monday night. It was 2-2 the week before that, so we're nip and tuck at the moment. This week, Kieran, we'll go to you first on all of these. England against Ireland, what do you see happening in this one?
I have England 24-17, just because they've had a really tough start to the campaign, and I think they're going to come out and try and put on a show after their dismal performance above against Scotland and getting hoodwinked by France. And I think Ireland are on a good curve after the win last week, but I just fancy England just to take them, unfortunately. I'd be shouting for Ireland, don't worry, but I think England by 7.
Manu Tuilagi, obviously 5-0 against Ireland. The 5 times he's played against us, he's won every single time. But I think that this is going to be the one time where he doesn't win. And obviously, I'm trying to make up some ground here, but I'm going to go for Ireland with the upset. You've got 7 points. Bookmakers are all on your side, Kieran, but I actually think that there's an opportunity here for us without the Vinopolas to smash England up, to smash them early, to smash them often, and to get in their heads and to just squeak a win.
Saturday, the early game in the Premier League is Chelsea against Tottenham. Kieran, will it be redemption for Frank Lampard?
Yeah, I think so. I think Chelsea are going to get this. I think either 2-0 or 2-1. I go with 2-1, but I do think Chelsea, they'll have to bounce back from the weekend. I hope he starts Giroud. I was at the game on Monday night. Batshuayi, he's just not at it. He missed a sitter of a chance. And I think Giroud just causes them more problems, especially with the amount of attacking midfielders we have. He's a good man to hold up the ball, and he's also good in the air when the ball comes in. So if they go with him, that's obviously counting Abraham being out.
I'm going for a draw in this game. I think that Spurs are going to play very defensively, and I don't think that Chelsea, as you point out, have the player power at the moment to actually break them down. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's scoreless, but if they do score, I think that Spurs can get at least one, and it's going to be a 1-1 draw.
And finally, Saturday night, this should be good in Croke Park here in Dublin against Donegal. What do you see in this one?
I swung both ways with this one, to be quite honest with you, because I thought Donegal would be coming down and they would have seen what Monaghan had done last week, and they would capitalise on that, and I think they have slightly better players than Monaghan. But I think Dublin will have a lot of home truths last week after that. They got out of jail, and I think you're going to see an answer from the weekend with as strong as the team is that they've put out so far this year, and I have Dublin by 2.
Yeah, look, I'm going to go exactly the same thing. I think that Donegal are going to stick it up to them. Dublin haven't won one game in the league so far. A couple of draws in there as well, and I actually think they're going to win this weekend as well.
Good stuff. Kieran, thanks a million for taking the call.
Thanks, lads.
Shot Clock again, same time, same Woo-hoo! Place next week on OTBAM, Thursday
winner,
mornings.
Chicken
always.
Dinner.
Well done. You're back in the game.
I can't believe you can screw this one up for me as well.
Keep your top on for now this summer. Hey.
OTBAM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.